you. It is Tuesday, September 7th, 5:30 p.m., and invite those who are here for a public hearing held by the Tompkins County Legislature concerning Proposed Law E of 2021, a local law amending Chapter 32 of the Tompkins County Code of Ethics. Is there anyone here to speak to the public hearing? Yep, I do. Robert Lynch?
Good evening.
Good evening.
Robert Lynch, 175 Gray Road, Town of Enfield. I sent the legislators my written comments today, but I was advised that to make them into the record, they have to be read, so I'm here to read them. On July 1st, I spoke before your legislature's Government Operations Committee regarding the Tompkins County Code of Ethics and the committee chair's prior suggestion that the county establish a code of conduct for legislators. To that point, I told the committee, quote, "I agree. I think that you ought to think very seriously about a code of conduct. I think one of the things that I would like to see in a code of conduct is some ground rules regarding political activity in and outside of legislative meetings. I think there are bounds, appropriate bounds, and I am not going to define them here. But I think it would be wise to know that we can say what we can say in meetings and how we influence legislative decisions." That's a quote from me back then. "I've reviewed the proposed revisions to the Tompkins County Code of Ethics, changes placed before the hearing tonight. Most are minor editorial adjustments, together holding limited substantive impact. However, in line with my July 1st comments to the Government Operations Committee, I offer here a further amendment. I would insert an additional subparagraph 6 to Section 3 of the Code of Ethics. And that subparagraph, under paragraph General Prohibition on Use of Office or Employment for Private Gain, here's what I would add, subparagraph 6. Quote, "No county officer or employee shall misuse his or her position while performing official duties to advocate for or against the election of a candidate competing in any local, state, national, or other governmental election in which Tompkins County residents might participate, nor while performing official duties, use his or her position to advocate for or against a ballot referendum affecting any other governmental jurisdiction, apart from his or her participating for or against an official action on such referendum to be taken collectively by county government as a whole." End of quote. Now back to me tonight. I believe that this additional paragraph to the Tompkins County Code of Ethics would establish a clear standard and draw a firm line to limit county legislators and the officers and personnel this county employs from abusing the privileges of their office or appointment while in public meetings or while performing official government service. A legislative forum should never be used as a political soapbox. The addition of this proposed paragraph would not restrict this county legislature or its members from debating or enacting official resolutions that either endorse or oppose county or statewide referenda, nor would it prohibit individual legislators or employees from advocating for political candidates or issues while on their own personal time. It would only limit the abuse of official privilege. I believe the additional paragraph I propose deserves serious consideration, whether at this meeting or at a future opportunity. I believe it should be added to the Code of Ethics. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lynch. Is there anyone else here to speak to the public hearing concerning the local law amending Chapter 32 of the Tompkins County Code of Ethics? Seeing no one, I will close the public hearing and open the September 7th, 2021 meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature. Please join me in the pledge. Roll call of members.
Rich John?
Here.
Dan Klein?
Here.
Ann Corman?
Here.
Mike Lane?
Here.
Dave McKenna?
Here.
Glenn Morey?
Here.
Martha Robertson?
Here.
Leslie Schill?
Here.
Mike Sigler?
Here.
Shauna Black?
Here.
Amanda Champion?
Here.
Deborah Dawson?
Here.
Henry Granison? Leslyn McBean Claiborne?
Present.
13 members present.
Thank you. We will move on. Just to acknowledge that we have a couple of legislators who are joining us remotely, Martha Robertson and Ann Corman. I have a couple of proclamations this evening, or the communications you would have received. And if I can stop my glasses from fogging up, I can read the proclamations. The first proclamation. Whereas the 500-year-old Latinx culture, steeped in tradition and centered in principles of family and community, strengthens the fabric of our entire society, and whereas Latinx people have been a part of this nation from its very inception, their presence in its territories contributing to shape its society and culture, and whereas many Latinx people live and work in obscurity, their contributions to the common good never achieving the recognition they deserve, and whereas Latinx people serve the United States at the highest levels of business, government, education, science, and the military, and whereas Tompkins County is home to an active, growing, and civically engaged Latinx community, and whereas virtually every aspect of our community's life has been influenced by Latinx, whether in arts, medicine, government, labor, business, or volunteerism, and whereas the Tompkins County community enthusiastically celebrates Latinx Heritage Month from September 15th through October 15th, and whereas September 15th was chosen as the starting point for the celebration because it is the anniversary of independence of five Latin American countries, namely Costa Rica, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and Nicaragua. Now, therefore, I, Leslyn McBean Claiborne, Chair of the Tompkins County Legislature, do hereby proclaim the month of September 15th, 2021, through October 15th, 2021, as Latinx Heritage Month, and together with our entire community, join in celebration and recognition of the Latinx community and salute the Latino Civic Association of Tompkins County for its outstanding work on behalf of Latinx people throughout Central New York. Signed the 7th day of September in the year 2021. And I know that... Okay, you can go ahead and clap. And I do want to invite Patricia to please come and receive this proclamation. I'll come around.
Well, thank you very much to the Tompkins County Legislature and to the Tompkins County in general for your support and embracing this celebration. Latino Heritage Month is a celebration that's focused on Latinx culture and traditions. But I also want to take this moment to say thank you, not just for embracing the celebratory aspect of this month, and for your continued support and interest in the month-long of festivities that we hold, but also I want to thank the county for your support for this last year and a half, which has been so difficult for all of us, especially as regards making sure that everyone in the county had access to tests regardless of migratory condition, which we greatly appreciated. And also, thank you very much for your interest in working towards the goal of making public information accessible to all the major language groups represented in the county. We deeply appreciate the county's interest and willingness to work towards those goals. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes, Mike.
I just want to say thank you to Patricia, especially. She was a wonderful help on our full count census committee, helping us get through to a lot of the Latinx community and language and advertising and other kinds of things. So she helped us a lot.
Thank you. Thank you for mentioning that. All right, our other proclamation. Whereas the month of September is nationally recognized as Suicide Awareness Month, and that the second week of September is further designated as National Suicide Prevention Week. And whereas over 47,000 Americans die each year by suicide. And whereas the county of Tompkins is not untouched by such deaths. And whereas deaths by suicide touch the lives of so many of our citizens. And whereas many organizations in Tompkins County recognize that deaths by suicide are a significant public health problem both locally and nationally, and that those deaths represent a community tragedy. And whereas many of those organizations have thus collaboratively joined their resources to promote public awareness of suicide prevention through the formation of the Tompkins County Suicide Prevention Coalition, and whereas it is recognized that suicidal deaths are preventable. Now, therefore, I, Leslie McBean Clairborn, Chairwoman of the Tompkins County Legislature, do hereby proclaim the second week of September 2021 as Suicide Prevention Week in Tompkins County, and recognize the efforts of our many community members to prevent the loss of Tompkins County citizens from death by suicide, signed the 7th day of September, 2021. And I thought I saw Beth. I can't see that far. Okay.
Behalf of many agencies, and thank you again for your support. 58 deaths by suicide in the last several years is way too many, and we need to prevent them. So thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the work that you do, Beth, and the work that suicide prevention does as well. You know, one of the privileges of this legislature is to do things like this, issue proclamations. But it does do a little number in your heart when you read something like 47,000 people die each year from suicide. And your last line in here is that suicide is preventable. So we need to continue to do as much as we can to help those citizens who are feeling suicidal, who have thoughts of suicidal, so that we prevent those deaths. So thank you very much, and we will make sure this proclamation gets to you and to the folks of suicide prevention. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, moving on with our agenda. I don't have any executive session scheduled for this evening, as far as I know. And we will move on to privileges of the floor for the public. I do have a number of cards for People who would like to speak on the privilege of the floor for the public, please be reminded, as
the board requires that you sign stated that it is a three-minute limit. But we'd love to hear from you. So the first card I have is Maddie Halpert. Welcome, Maddie.
It is of the utmost importance that we honor our county relationship with the Gaigong Nation by, as a county, officially recognizing the Council of Chiefs as the Cuban Nation's governing body and sharing such a statement with the Bureau of Indian Affairs while following Seneca County's lead to call on the BIA to revoke Clint Halftown status as federal representative. My name is Maddie and I live here in Ithaca, specifically on Cayuga Street, a few blocks from where I grew up. In Tompkins County, the word Cayuga is everywhere, from the lake to names of bike shops and doctor's offices. Despite the word's constant presence, I grew up absorbing the myth that Cayuga people are no longer here, let alone having awareness of the sovereign pieces
and ongoing governance within their territory. I only this year learned Cayuga people's original self-name, Gaigong. May all our myths be busted. Tonight, you have the chance to listen directly to a condoled Gaigong chief. He and other
people have encouraged me to speak to you as my fellow settlers, so I humbly do so. The myth painting indigenous people and nations as a thing of the past is one of many forms of colonial violence handed down to us from our ancestors. We have no choice but to inherit this history. However, we do choose how we shape the world of relationships we will pass to those who follow us. Thanks to those patterns of erasure, some hearing this may not feel you know enough to have a position on over a decade of statements by the Gaigong community, clan mothers, and the Council of Chiefs about Clint Halftown. You may not know that all these entities view Halftown as illegitimate and repeatedly instructed the BIA to revoke its federal representative status.
I feel too uninformed to comment on the fact that last year, Halftown ordered the overnight destruction of numerous Gaigong community spaces, including a schoolhouse used as a longhouse. If you don't feel that you can or should take a stand, I will make a few things clear. Halftown holds power because of our federal government. Our silence to date is itself a form of colonial violence. And to clarify, there is no law of any kind requiring the county to use any BIA decision around who to recognize as leadership of this indigenous nation. And you might be tempted to think, we have to listen to both sides. But holding on to such a position here would deny your responsibility in a way that, again, reinforces colonial violence because one side has been around about 20 years and only exists because of funds and privileges that come from a position created by our own U.S. government. It would be an outrage to put that individual on an equal plane with a system of governance, a law, the great law of peace, that is thousands of years old. And if you see this issue as irrelevant to us, let me say this. Whether we listen to Gaigong people and publicly commit to relating with the Council of Chiefs, or we choose to stay silent, we already have a relationship to the Gaigong Nation and people, both by being represented by our federal government acting as it is, and by living on this land. An uneven relationship of neglect and denial is still a relationship, and no matter what street we live on, signs reminding us of this relationship are literally all around the places we call home. This legislature has the unique responsibility of acting on this issue at the collective level. And although we are honestly overdue for taking this stand, the county can do so now at a critical time when momentum is building, thanks in part to neighboring counties having already taken leadership to act in response to parallel calls. Thank you.
Thank you, Mandy. Next on line, this is Michael Watson.
Hello.
I'm not sure the microphone is on.
Kind of.
It's a little bit hard here, so speak loudly, please.
Sounds good. Hello, my name is Michael Watson. I'm a member of Tompkins County and a landowner here, which means that I owe a great debt to the Gaigong people for land that was stolen from them post the Civil War. And that is partly why I'm here in solidarity today to continue Maddie's statements, because we anticipated that it might get cut short. Although we are honestly overdue for taking this stand, the country, the county, can do so now at a critical time when momentum is building, thanks in part to neighboring counties having already taken leadership to act in response to parallel calls. Such a statement is not the only way the county can engage in our relationship with the Gaigong Nation. For example, while Resolution U, which I urge you to support, frames conservation of the Bell Station property as a public access issue, our county's relationship to that land represents a critical political opportunity going forward for the county as a public entity to creatively lead in the growing land back movement by working toward the return of that land to the Gayakono people through the Council of Chiefs. In doing so, we would be lessening the injustices and debts we will pass on to the next generation. For now, I urge you to listen to the Gayakono people tonight and in the future. Work toward relationships of healing by sending this message to the BIA. You will be taking but one small critical step on behalf of the citizens of this county to leave our collective relationship with the Gayakono Nation a little better than you found it. Thank you.
Thank you. Next on my list is Veronica Pilar.
Hi, can you hear me fine?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thanks for having me. It's good to be in person with most of you. I'm going to try to talk about two things in 3 minutes. First, the resolution about contributing some money toward building out some broadband infrastructure in Newfield. Basically would urge you to support it. In particular, I want to say we all know broadband's a basic utility, like that everyone should have access to, just like water and heating and housing. I also happened to talk to Sunny Miller recently, the technology director in Newfield Central Schools, who pointed out that this is really, she called it the great civil rights issue of our time, pointing out that Newfield, the least connected place in our county, is also where we have the highest proportion, at least counting by like students in schools, of poor folks, of special needs students, of Native Americans. And the internet access there would really fuel and support not only the folks in Newfield, but also the county as a whole, because it allows people living there to participate in the work, the play, all the things we say about the whole rest of the county. I'd ask you, if possible, not to make investing in this contingent on Newfield kicking in $5,000, because, again, this is not really just a Newfield issue. I'd ask you not to make it contingent on waiting for Spectrum to do anything, because Spectrum has had time, and we don't need to trust them with that. And I also have a question, because I couldn't figure it out, is who's going to own that fiber after the 25-75 split investing in it? But maybe I'll hear about that later. Second thing, building on what you just heard about this ask to essentially respect Gayakono sovereignty, I just wanted to, I know, I think you have or will heard from Sam George, but speaking again from the settler perspective, we know that we are conducting all our activities on land that was in the past violently taken from Gayakono people. And so even if they don't live in the county right now, I know a lot of these calls came out of a community in Seneca Falls, but we have a responsibility to these folks to at minimum respect their say in who their leaders are and who we should be dealing with when we try to have a U.S. indigenous nation-to-nation relationship. By doing nothing, we're sort of implicitly accepting that Clint Halftown, who's recognized by the BIA, is the leader to be dealt with, which, as you heard, is completely inappropriate. He's not being respectful or caring to his people at all. So instead, I would ask that you take what might be the like a surprising and unfamiliar step to basically follow what's in, I think, the draft resolution that you all have, but hopefully the non-controversial step of just respecting indigenous sovereignty and understanding that the Gayakono Council of Chiefs are the appropriate Gayakono leaders to be dealing with in all matters, and advocate for this up to higher levels of government as well as this legislature commonly does. Thanks.
Thank you. And the last card, thank you, Veronica. The last card I have before me is Sam George.
Oh, it's not from San Jose. Now, Sagoigo, what I said was thank you, peace, and greetings to everyone. I was told to tell you we're not going to take your land. We want you to acknowledge that you are on our land, have been. I know that the history that probably, when you went into school, you probably didn't hear anything about this. But our original territory starts at Lake Ontario, comes down both sides of the lake, into Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Ohio. How I know that it goes into Ohio because we had a Haudenosaunee Environmental Task Force person would get calls from Ohio and they were going to put up a tower of some sort. So they recognize that they're on our land. What we need from here in Tompkins County, oh, first of all, let me get thanks for giving me a few minutes to say what I need to say. Those that are, we're informing Tompkins County of what's going on up north. Cayuga and Seneca have already committed to doing something about this guy, which I call the sick one, because he's doing a lot of damage and he's trying to commit more terrorist acts on his own people. And so the Council of Chiefs have decided that we don't want to recognize him no more. We don't do that to our people. I'm sure you wouldn't like it if somebody came to your house and told you to get out. Without any recourse. Well, this is what he's trying to do. But he doesn't have the power to do that. I understand that today through us, the Council of Chiefs, we're a traditional people. We have a way to decide those things that we need to decide. It's called consensus. It's not a majority. It's a consensus of everyone involved. We have five clans. If a decision came up to put up a longhouse somewhere, they would probably talk about it and all agree. Everyone, all the clans agree. There's over 5,000 people involved. They all would agree that it's okay to put up that longhouse. And us as chiefs and sachems, we're the one to protect that. Anything that comes from the outside, we need to deal with. We'll deal with. And we'll let the clan mother know, because she put us up there to do that. We'll let her know what we're dealing with, and she'll take it back to the family to let them know what's going on. So we have a consensus. We also have a great law of peace that we live by. It's not about being terrorists. It's about being peaceful. And I said this before when I was down here. We are a peaceful people. And as I know right now, the young lady said there's nobody living here, but we found out there's two of us down here. And we have a couple of members that go to Cornell College right now. So it's going to be more people coming. That's why we want everyone to be noticed, put on notice that we are going to be here. We're not going anywhere. We are going to perform our traditions, our culture. One of the things that happened when we had our school building and everything was that our teacher had gone back to where he learned. And his question was, where is this great waterfall that you talk about in one of our ceremonies? And the old-timer elder told him, he says, well, that's down on the west side of the lake, on the south side. You'll know it when you get there. Well, when he got back here, he took a ride with one of our friends, and they brought him down in that area. And when he got there, he started crying. Because he knew at that time that's where the original ceremony started. You call it Taganic, I call it Tufanuk. That's how I read it. But we have a fish ceremony that happens every year in the spring when the water breaks or when the ice breaks. So as if you just heard, we do things by the weather. We do things how the plants grow. We do things whether the berries are out. We do ceremonies like the first one is a tree. We give thanks to the maple tree because it gives us that liquid that we make into syrup. And we make enough syrup to last throughout the whole year. Then we go on throughout the whole year doing certain ceremonies. The next one we're going to be doing is called green corn. That's when the corn is not quite ripe yet, but we give thanks for that. We do a ceremony for that. And then when it does get ripe, it'll be a big ceremony that happens. And most of the nations will come if they're vaccinated and wear a mask. And that's what's been going on for our ceremonies lately, is everybody wears a mask and they need to be vaccinated. We still have those that don't want to because they think they have that right, but I'm not going to get into that. So, again, I want to give thanks for Deanna for having that first meeting that we had. If you all go home and look at the recording that happened, it'll give you a short story on what's been going on here. But we need that guy gone. We need him out of here. Because he's doing too much damage to everyone. Not just the people. The community. He may be coming down here, but I doubt it. It's too far to walk. But so if you hear anything, let me know. And I'll come down and deal with it for you. That's how the Two-Row Wampum Treaty works. Our original treaty was the Two-Row Wampum. It was called Gatsuenta. When the people came across the ocean, they saw that we had plenty of everything here and they really liked being here. But they wanted to make sure that they were okay with the people that were here. So they decided, first they decided that they were going to call us their children. And we went back and had a meeting and said, well, that's not even right. So we took it back to them and said, we'll be brothers. And they had a discussion and they said that sounded very good. That way they can't tell us, you know, as parents tell their children what to do and where to go and all that other stuff. They thought that was equal. That's why when you see the belt, it's three rows of white wampum, two purple, three rows of white, two purple, and three rows of white again. The two purple lines are one is the boat, the ship that came across the ocean with all those people, and the other one's the canoe with all our people in it. The first thing that they said that this treaty was going to be intact as long as the water flowed, grass was green, and the sun comes up in the east. And so it's still in effect today. And how that works is that we don't come into your ship and tell you what to do. You don't come into my canoe and tell me what to do. But we can ask each other for help. That was one of the things I understood from what happened in Mohawk country a few years ago. And they asked us to come and help dwell this thing that was going on. And so we did, and it became peaceful, and they gave us thanks for that. And that's how that works. So, again, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Sasan George. I have. Thank you all for sharing the information with us and for the written information that we received as well. I have next Peggy Coleman.
Ithaca Tompkins County Convention and Visitors Bureau Director. I know you are working very hard to develop a process to determine the investment of the ARPA funds, and we recognize that you are working in a very thoughtful way to encourage that these dollars are producing the best return on investment to the residents of Tompkins County. And as you work through the development of the process, I urge you to use the Tompkins County Recovery Strategy document that was developed by a collaboration of economic development organizations along with local governments as your roadmap to see immediate return on those funds. As demonstrated in our work in phase one and phase two, the residents of Tompkins County have already benefited from the work of this collaboration. Phase three outlines specific redevelopment and revitalization projects, which are ready to implement. They address targeted sectors, workforce needs, and infrastructure needs. I also ask that the Tompkins County Legislature work in partnership with the City of Ithaca and all of our local municipalities to invest in and implement the Tompkins County Recovery Strategy immediately. These businesses are still hurting. The community is still hurting, and this plan is ready and can make an impact even while you are developing your full process. So thank you for your service, and thank you for your consideration. I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Peggy. And you're right. We are working as diligently and as hard as we can, so thank you for recognizing that.
Is there anyone else on the privilege of the floor for the public? Peggy was the last part I have. Okay. We will move on to municipal officials. Oh, did I miss someone?
There's one Gargano person who's outside who might want to speak. If that's still a possibility, can we check?
I'll let them speak when they come in. Just let me know who it is.
All right, thank you so much.
That would be fine. In the meantime, we'll move on to reports from municipal officials, and I do see George McGonigal on screen. All the persons of First Ward, City of Ithaca. Welcome, George. Good evening, George.
Yes. Am I coming through clearly?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, it's good to see you all. I'll tell you a little bit about our last Common Council meeting was last Wednesday. We honored our outgoing city historian, Mary Tomlin, who's also a former member of council and a pillar of our community. And we hate to see her go, but she's retiring as the city historian. And we gave her a good send-off. We had a light agenda, but we had a number of presentations. One was from the farmers market. They have a major redesign plan in mind, and if they get the funding, that will start probably next year with a redesign of the parking area, but the buildings would be redone, and the waterfront would be redone. A major project. Also at that meeting, we voted to put funds aside for expanding the Black Diamond Trail. There's going to be a footbridge across the flood control channel at the base of Cecil B. Malone Drive. That's already approved, and that'll be done next year. But then the trail will be extended southwards. There'll be two more footbridges over the inlet, and it will connect with the town's trail and the Bridge to Nowhere. And that will extend up South Hill. So in the near future, there'll be a trail all the way from South Hill to the Deganic State Park. So we're looking forward to that. That's a good project. Nobody's against that. We voted to expand the East Hill Historic District and added 19 more houses to that. Most of them are along, East Court Street and North Aurora Street. So we extended that historic district. We had a presentation surrounding our police reimagining task force, and Dominic may be able to give you more details about this presently, but they have developed a website, which is www.publicsafetyreimagined, and anybody in the community can log into that and become part of that and make suggestions and share ideas about what they'd like to see in the police reimagining process. And finally, I will say that GIAC has its annual meeting on the 16th of September, and everybody's welcome to that. But I'm not going to steal Leslyn's thunder. She can give you more detail than I will.
I have no thunder there. Go for it.
Well, it's the annual meeting, and it's going to be virtual again this year. And if people want to learn about what we're doing at GIAC, they can log on. So I think that's all I have, unless there's questions.
Questions for George? Mike Lane?
Hi, George. When reading about the city looking to change its charter, including the position of mayor, possibly, can you give us any idea of where that's going or what's happening at this point with that, when that would be decided?
Thank you. I should have mentioned that. There is a group studying that possibility. What they've come up with is a plan that would create a city manager who would be hired, not elected, and that person would oversee all the city departments, which is what the mayor does now. The mayor's role would change and be more related to the politics and the ceremonial aspect of city government. And the city manager would be hired and fired by common council. The thinking is that it would be more like your form of government, in which you have a county manager, and that seems to work pretty well for you. So that's what's being proposed. In order to do that, the city charter would have to be changed, and it would have to go before the voters as part of a referendum. And that will not happen this November, certainly. If it continues to progress, and it looks like it will, that would happen next year, the vote.
Thank you.
All right. Other questions for George? Mike Sickler?
Hey, George, I might not really a question. I just wanted to compliment your staff, actually, on the historic district. I actually have a house in the historic district. And it was pleasant. They called, they talked to me about what it meant. They told me what was going to happen and what it did and did not mean. And so you have a great team. They really, they were very open and honest about what was going on. And I appreciated that. So thank you.
I appreciate that comment. Brian is a top-notch member of the city staff, and I will return that. I will tell him what you said. Thank
That'd
you.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you again, George.
You're welcome.
And now while we're on the municipal official, and then I'll get to the other two members of the public.
I have Robert Lynch, Town of Enfield, Town Board.
Hello again. I am putting on my other hat tonight as councilperson for the town of Enfield. Wanted to give you an update on some things going on in Enfield, but most importantly, and this is a timely matter, I want to make a shout out for a particular organization that serves our community well and to make an appeal on behalf of that organization. So let me speak to that first. On July 20th, I spoke before your chamber as a public citizen, private individual, urging you to assign nearly $20 million in American Rescue Plan funds, as I believe the federal government intended they be spent, namely as I said, purposed for people, assigned for specific initiatives to remedy community, economic, and social ills created or exacerbated by the pandemic. You did not take my advice. You chose a different course. But you reserved the option to assign future fund balance surpluses to address those community ills. A resolution before you tonight would initiate that process. It's words I have not yet seen. But let's start here. I wish to place item one before you for your funding consideration. Financial aid to construct a larger, regionally responsive Enfield food pantry. Our Enfield food pantry stands as the most ambitious of its kind in Tompkins County. Despite strained facilities on the first floor of Enfield's Town Court building, a converted 1940s firehouse, we serve between 325 and 570 households weekly. Open a portion of 2 days, Sundays and Mondays. We do more than other local food pantries. We have refrigerators and freezers. We serve fresh dairy and produce. We have frozen meats. It's amazing to think that we hand out as much as 1.25 million pounds of food a year. Our pantry's mission is to serve as an emergency food source, moving from a charity model to one of empowerment and food security. So please help us help the pantry. The economic fallout from COVID-19 has swelled weekly demand. People of limited means, increasingly unemployed this past year, simply cannot make ends meet without us. Our pantry makes do with what we have. Limited parking, inadequate shelter, patrons and volunteers forced to stand outdoors in the rain and snow, outdated freezers and coolers that break down, perishables that we can't hold over for lack of sufficient refrigeration. We've cobbled together a mid-20th century pantry as best we can to meet 21st century needs. We need a new home, somewhere in Enfield. Director Gene Owens envisions a semi-supermarket of sorts, one open 5 days a week, not just two, one serving well over 500 families weekly, one with regional reach, expanding our volunteer base from 40 to as many as 60. Simply put, we need to do so much more. Please help us. Director Owens estimates a new food pantry might cost between $1.25 to $1.5 million. We don't expect you to give us all the money, just enough to march us toward our mission. The more you help, the sooner we can build. Think about purpose. This is spending the ARPA money the way it was intended to be spent, as purposed for people, your people, those deserving families. This pandemic has hit the hardest. And with that appeal, I can tell you a little bit more about what's going on in Enfield briefly. We are dealing with COVID-19 as you are, and we have a resolution on tomorrow's agenda that would establish, like you have done, a vaccination mandate for employees in the town of Enfield, our employees in town government. It's controversial. I'm not sure it will pass. I proposed it. I may revise it, but that's what we're doing. We also have a mask mandate resolution that's before us tomorrow night. We have a lot of things to consider, and those are the high points. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lynch. Any questions for Mr. Lynch? No? All right. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for the update, as well as the appeal. Please indulge me while I just return. We have just two other members of the public who came in, and we'd love to give them an opportunity to share with us. And once again, I should not be cute and put on my glasses. Darren, is it Darren Kettle?
Hello.
Hi, Darren.
I'm Darren Kettle. I'm here to speak on the issues with the Cougar Nation and everything that happened back in
Excuse me, Darren, can you speak into the microphone?
I'm sorry, can you hear me now?
Louder, please.
Yeah, I'm here to speak on the matter of what happened in February 22nd in Seneca Falls with the Cayuga Nation. I was one of the Cayuga people that was there. And I'm sorry, it's affected me to this day, even still. Being pulled out of my car at gunpoint, being restrained, being shown a piece of paper saying that it was a search warrant, and then asking to leave the property, and still concerned that I'm dealing with is Clint Halftown and his so-called Cayuga Nation police possibly coming in and kicking me out of my house and putting me out in the street, because there's the Cayuga people here, we are a community. We are looking forward to working with other communities and towns to establish a government-to-government good relationship. And I believe Clint Halftown and doing that back in February has jeopardized everything that we are trying to do. And it put a lot of us, especially me, in fear of where I live and trying to better myself to move on and do proper things for me and my family. And it's just the constant fear of what he may do and what he could do is what really, really affects me. Because I am an outstanding member of the community. I do work at the local Walmart up in Seneca Falls. And like I said, I'm doing what I can to provide for my family, my son, my nieces, my nephews. But I feel he is undermining everything that we're trying to do and push us back to pretty much asking him for help when he hasn't really established a helping hand for us. And the fact of helping us get a community center for the kids, daycare program, any kind of health services for like our elderly and a child's needs. And it's pretty much a dictator. Is if we don't follow him, he's going to do what he can to boot us out and not even recognize us. And as Cayuga people, that is not what we're about. So, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thanks, Darren. And next is Leanna Young.
Namaste, Anot Swagero. My name is Leanna Young. I come to you today as a mother, Gaikonot mother, and a community advocate for my people in Seneca Falls, Barrick, and Waterloo. I come to you today to just give you some encouragement to consider creating a working partnership with the Gaikonot.
Leanna, can you come just a little closer to the mic? Yeah, thank you.
I come to you today to offer you encouragement to consider creating a working partnership with the Gaikonot Nation, chiefs and clan mothers. Our intentions are pure. Our goal is only to create sustainable living for our people right now and our faces yet to be seen, to create something for our future generations to grow from and to keep going. We are right now, we still are taking care of our people. We have a garden. We have an agricultural program. We are working on providing language services for our children and for our community members. We are still trying to rebuild from the destruction of February 2020. It affected a lot of us, my brother included. He was there that night. But we are working past that, and we are heading in brighter directions and just trying to live our life the way that our Creator intended so, and doing so also working with the outside communities so that we both can prosper and we both can continue living on this beautiful land that we have here in Cayuga Lake. There's so much I could say, and I only have like a minute 26, so I'm going to just...
That's all right.
We are working with other counties as well to create relationships and better communications moving forward. We do intend to do the best that we can for everyone involved. We also follow the two-row wampum. That's a treaty that's very important to us. It establishes the relationships that you and I both have going along this river of life. It signifies that we have our canoe, you have your ship, and neither one will tell the other what to do or how to go about it. That's the relationship we intend to have, and we know that we need to create agreements with our outside communities in order to keep that a nice, calm river so that we can all get along. I can attest to everything that Darren has said. I have seen things happen in the Cayuga Nation for 25 years, and I can assure you that nothing good will come from negotiating or making agreements with Clint Halftown and his faction. It could only be more turmoil and destruction. That's all I can say right now. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thanks, Deanna. Thanks, everyone. And now we're going to move on to privilege of floor for legislators.
Thank you. As everybody knows, we're having a real spike in our COVID cases, and this means a lot of things to a lot of different people. I want to speak briefly about what it means to our health department employees. The county health department is the one that deals with this on a day-to-day basis. For every positive case, contact is made with that individual, and if they develop symptoms, if they get sick, then a more intensive contact is maintained with that individual. So you can imagine on a day, last week we had 130 cases in one day, and then subsequent lots of double-digit days since then, a lot of pressure on our health department employees. So the reason I'm bringing it up is because Tompkins County is looking for additional help, additional employees to work for the health department on a per diem basis, to help with our contact investigation process. And we have issued a press release, and I just wanted to help spread the word that we are looking for medical personnel that are interested in helping us in this way on a temporary, part-time basis. And you should check the county website for more information about how to apply. The last time this happened, approximately 6 months ago, we put out this appeal, and we had a very large response, and it was very gratifying that the community stepped in this way, and we're looking for some kind of response again in that manner. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that, Dan. Amanda?
Thanks, Leslin. I want to thank folks who came to speak and tell us a little bit more about what's going on. I'm not versed in the situation that you're facing, and I'm sorry to hear that it's so difficult. I guess I just wanted to say I hear you, and I appreciate you taking the time to be here and talk to us. I guess I'm I'm not sure what to say beyond that, but thank you. On a very different note, I just wanted to announce to the public, anybody who's listening, that the county is still looking for volunteers to serve on our independent redistricting commission. We need 9 volunteers. Applications are open through September 15th. Please share this with your networks. If you haven't, reach out to folks that you think might want to serve. We hope to have the commission appointed by December, and then this commission will work independently to look at all of our census data and the district lines and make sure that we are accurately representing our population. So please, anybody who's listening, reach out to our legislature clerk or any of your representatives, and we can give you more information. So thank you.
Thank you, Amanda. Anyone else? Michaeline.
A number of months ago, I spoke here about my opinion that it was time to end our war in Afghanistan, our longest war, an unwinnable war, as history has shown with various groups going back to Alexander the Great and the Persians and the Ottomans and other people who have tried to enforce their rule in a mountain country filled with many, many different tribes having different purposes, the Russians and now us. I think what we did there and going in there was the right thing to do after we had been attacked by people who were sheltered by the Taliban. I'm as shocked as anyone at how fast the Taliban has been able to take over, and it pierces my heart to see what they're doing, particularly to the rights of women, and how they're going to impress a very 8th century view of the way people should act socially among each other, and to continue to go forward with the suppression of women's rights. But unfortunately, we aren't able to solve that problem. People are going to have to do it themselves over there, and the seeds have been planted of democracy, and we'll have to see how it plays out. Sadly, our troops who, at the end, we lost 13 in a ridiculous, nonsensical suicide bombing. What purpose when we were already announced we were leaving? You tell me that. I want to thank all of our veterans, men and women, the people who worked with them, and certainly the people from Afghanistan, many of whom we have been able to get out, for their efforts. But democracy is a very, very gentle thing, and it can be easily upset by forces of evil. And we've seen that in our own country recently. And how important it is that we every day be thankful and work very hard to preserve our democracy and to try to keep it as a model for those in other countries. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. All the legislators. Did I miss Annie?
I want to thank you for your proclamations earlier tonight, and also just to let folks know, I when I was younger, I tried to commit suicide, and with the help of friends and organizations, I was able to learn that it does get better. And so just a message to people, you know, short and sweet, it does get better. And thank you for all the organizations that help folks in that horrible situation where you don't think there's anything worth living for. The second thing I wanted to talk about was I would like us to consider on another night of this meeting the resolution that was put forth to us regarding recognizing the Gayakono Nation. And when talking about Afghanistan, you know, I think we need to remember too, here's people within our own country who are asking us to help them, the, you know, and with the stories that I've heard, this is a tyrannical leader who was taken over illegally, and the people of the nation are just asking us to not recognize this person and urge the Bureau of Indian Affairs to also revoke this person's designation as their representative. So I would like us to talk more about that at some point coming up soon. Thank you.
Thank you, Annie. Anyone else? All right, I will also very quickly just echo Amanda's thanks.
The folks who came out to speak with us and to let us know about what's going on, because, you know, certainly we don't. Thank you for the materials also that we received. Deanna, thank you for meeting with Sachem George and others this afternoon and getting some more information. We really do appreciate that. I also just want to take a moment and recognize, as Mike brought up, the war in Afghanistan, that this Saturday, will mark 20 years since the horror of 9/11 happened, September 11, 2001. It will be the 20-year anniversary this Saturday of that tragedy. I've had the opportunity to watch a program on television that has been very moving, to listen to some of the survivors tell the stories of being pulled out of the rubble and not knowing whether they'll be here to speak or not, or not knowing what was going on. And so many people today still suffering from some of the illnesses caused by that incident. So thanks, and I hope that on that day that we all take a moment to remember those who, as always, gave the ultimate sacrifice of their life. So, thank you. I have no appointments tonight. They're on the consent agenda. Because I know we have our COVID report for this evening, I am just going to move us along. Let me just check. Is anybody waiting? Do I have any staff waiting for anything? I don't see anybody on queue. So that we can get that. Martha?
Yeah, unless I see Megan McDonald, we have some housing things here. Kathy Schlaughter may be here for the continuum of care resolution. Those are some guesses. So maybe if we get at least to the consent agenda.
I was going to see what do we have on the consent agenda. Maybe we can move the things on the consent agenda before we go to the report. The screen wasn't live where I can see everybody, but now I can, so I can see all who is up there. So, thank you, Dominic. Why don't we go ahead and take up the consent agenda, because I think most of what we're looking for is on the there, although there's some stuff on the HED as well.
Yeah. So, I'll do that. So, the consent agenda, resolutions and appointments to be voted on as a group, unless any member of the legislature requested a resolution or appointment be instead included separately and individually as part of the business of standing or special committees. Let's start with the advisory board appointments. I have to the Strategic Tourism Planning Board, Kenneth Jupiter, at-large member, and Alexis Zaharis Grimm, lodging representative member. Term expiring December 31st of 2022, and Kenneth Jupiter term expiring December 31st of 2021. And I will read the titles of the resolutions on the consent agenda. On the Facilities and Infrastructure Committee, Resolution A, audit of final payments, Streeter Associates, Inc., Passenger Terminal Expansion Phase 2, Ithaca Tompkins International Airport, ID 10311. Resolution B, acceptance of Federal Aviation Administration, FAA grant, reconstruct aircraft rescue firefighting snow removal equipment. Equipment building design, Ithaca Tompkins International Airport, ID 10317. Oh, I don't know how people with glasses do this. These things are fogging up. I can't see. Wow. Resolution C, approval of Federal Aviation Administration grant acceptance. Rehabilitate Taxiway A, Phase 4, Taxiway F, and reconfigure Taxiways E and E design at the Ithaca Tompkins International Airport, ID 10318. Resolution D, authorizing acceptance of a Federal Aviation Administration grant, American Rescue Plan Act, for operating costs, debt service, loss of revenue, and concessions, Ithaca Tompkins International Airport, ID 10319. Resolution E, authorizing acceptance of an anticipated Federal Aviation Administration grant for rehabilitation of Taxiway A, Phase 3, GA Apron Construction, Ithaca Tompkins International Airport, ID 10312. The Government Operations Committee, Resolution F, Tompkins County Center for History and Culture Facility Operations Agreement, ID 10350. The Planning, Energy, and Environmental Quality Committee, Resolution G, abolishing the Home Ownership Oversight Committee and the Local Empire Zone Administration Board, ID 10261. Under Housing and Economic Development Committee, Resolution H, negative declaration for authorizing disbursements of Community Housing Development Fund Award for Carpenter Park Apartments, ID 10332. Resolution I, authorizing disbursement of the Community Housing Development Fund Award for Carpenter Park Apartments, ID 10333. Resolution J, making a negative determination of environmental significance in relation to resolution blank, acceptance of New York State Homes and Community Renewal Community Development Block Grant, Micro Enterprise Grant Funding, ID 10345. Resolution K, acceptance of New York State Homes and Community Renewal Community Development Block Grant, Micro Enterprise Grant Funding, ID 10338. Resolution L, delegating to the Micro Enterprise Grant Review Committee the power to conduct environmental reviews and to make award decisions for specific project applications to the Tompkins County Micro Enterprise Program, ID 10346. Resolution M, abolishing the Economic Development Loan Oversight Committee, ID 10263. And that's the consent agenda. May I have someone move the consent agenda? Moved by Leslie Schill, seconded by Deb Dawson. Vote on the consent agenda. And it has to be, everything is roll call vote tonight because we have some of our members attending remotely.
Rich Jan?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Leslie Schill?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
13 ayes, 0 noes.
That carries unanimously. Thank you very much. Does that take care of most people who were waiting? Martha?
And then the next one on the list, I think, is also not controversial. Dan Schlover is waiting for us on Resolution N for the HHS Committee. Wonder if that could be taken up too.
On the Standing and Special Committee, Kathy Schlover waiting for...
It's Resolution N under
I'm looking at Shauna.
Yeah.
I'm happy to move it. I'd like to move appropriation from the contingent fund to the Human Services Coalition for Continuum of Care Strategic Action Plan, ID 10314.
May I have a second, please? Seconded by Martha Robertson. Discussion? Deborah?
I just had one question. Is $10,000 enough for what you're trying to get this person to get their arms around?
Is that for me? Can I answer? So truthfully, the proposals came in a little higher than that. We're trying to whittle them down now. And this was actually phase one. Phase two is actually taking the information that we're getting from the study and then looking at actually building what funds are available out there and what it would take to build them. So this is just for phase one. And I think this will be fine. We can, shrink the proposal down a little bit. This is $10,000 from the county, and it's being matched by $10,000 from the city.
Okay. Thank you, Kathy.
Sure.
Other questions? All right, let's vote.
Rich Sharon?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Foreman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Leslie Schill?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Linda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Cook? Leslie McBean
right.
Clairborne? I zero no.
That's all right. Every now and again I get a new name. That carries unanimously. Thank you. Is there anything else that you can, for a committee chairs that's on the agenda you think we can take care of that's not controversial, that people might be waiting for?
Anybody else waiting that you can see? Committee chairs? No? All right. So we will move on to our reports. So reports from county administrator, county attorney, director of finance, our COVID report.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will jump in on behalf of County Administration. We have three updates tonight. I'm going to provide a very brief update and preview regarding the 2022 budget. And then Deanna Carruthers, our Chief Equity and Diversity Officer, is going to provide an update on the Reimagining Public Safety Initiative that was postponed from the last meeting. And then Amy Hendricks and Frank Krupa are going to talk about where we're at with COVID. So I'll just jump right in really briefly to update you all about the 2022 budget. Administration was originally scheduled to present at tonight's meeting. And as you know, I'll be presenting it next Tuesday instead. Just wanted to say I really appreciate the extra time. It's been very necessary for our new staff and administration to come up to speed and to resolve a lot of issues that we have been experiencing with our budget software, which seem to happen each year. But I did want to just make everyone aware of where we're at with the target. In April of this year, as you know, the legislature approved a maintenance of effort budget, which would result in levy growth of about 1.89%. We set all of the departmental targets in that fashion, and that's the way that we've operated. But prior to budget submission, as you know, some departments came forward with some critical staffing issues, which necessitated mid-year requests to the legislature for additional staffing or restored staffing. And this resulted in 5.5 additional FTEs being approved mid-year, which totaled approximately $440,000 in salary and fringe costs. And those respective departments' 2022 fiscal targets were adjusted accordingly per resolution. So I just wanted to give everyone the heads up that with the addition of these 5.5 FTEs, the resulting levy increase for maintenance of effort budget for 2022 changed from 1.89% to 2.73%, That's just, you know, again, maintenance of effort with those additional approved FTEs. So that's our starting point this year. We've received a total of 125 over target requests from departments and agencies, totaling about $7.825 million for 2022. For comparison's sake, in 2021, the over target requests were $3.6 million, and for 2020, they were $3.1 million. So that this is kind of where we're at. We're busy here still preparing and finalizing the budget that which you will have in hand next week. I hope this has whet your appetite for some great budget deliberations, and look forward to providing you with a full overview at next Tuesday's meeting and spending a lot more time together in the coming weeks. Unless there are questions about anything I've mentioned, I see a hand up, so I'll pause there.
Yeah, Lisa, I think we're all just trying to pick our jaws up off of the heads up. We look forward to getting the budget. Any questions? Or, oh, we don't look forward to getting it.
Oh,
we don't getting the budget, but we'll take it if you send it along.
Yeah, we
do. Any questions, Lisa? Thank you for the heads up. All right, let the budget deliberations begin.
Uh-huh.
Oh, Martha, yes.
Yeah, hi. Wow, Lisa, do you have any idea what our tax cap level would be?
Oh, spoiler alert, I do. it is 7.41%.
The tax cap would be 7.41%?
The tax cap?
Wow.
Yes.
Well, how did that happen?
Again, this is a spoiler alert. I'm giving away way too much, but I'll tell you more next week. But it had to
I'll
do,
wait for it.
Yeah, the towns and it had to do similar to the Dryden effect of a couple of years ago. So if you recall
that. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Take
care. Interesting. That's interesting. Do you happen to know? And we had a report from the comptroller about the retirement allocation from employers. Do you know where is that? That's kind of usually a big number too. Any idea about that?
You're trying to take the thunder from next week.
You just want to be able to. I just want to be able to sleep at night.
Yes, that has helped
hold
us.
Hold on, hold on.
Yeah.
What, Lisa?
That has helped us a great deal, factoring that in. That was a late revelation to us late August, and we've factored that in. So that has provided us with, over $1 million.
Okay. Thanks so much. Appreciate it. And good sure. luck in the, for the next week.
Thank you. Thank you. So with that, then, I'd like to turn it over to Deanna. For the Reimagining Public Safety update.
Good evening, everyone. Can you hear me?
Yes. Oh,
thank you. And I'm going to attempt to share a screen, being more than 6 feet away from Dominic. So we'll see how it goes.
Who's ringing? Oh. Thank you.
I'm sorry. All right.
Please go ahead.
It's a long night. You have a lot of information in front of you, so I'll be as expeditious as possible. When you approved the plans for reimagining public safety, we committed to doing a minimum of monthly updates once we were able to move forward. And which is our first update last week. Common Council received a similar presentation. So I also have my colleague Shelley Michelle Nunn here as well. In the event that you have questions about the city as well. So get it started. You're sharing screen live.
If you click view at the top on your top left, and then there should be a full screen option. There you go.
Thank you, Dominic.
Yep.
Second time's the charm. He did say that before.
to move forward. So our charge here is to move forward with executing Executive Order 203. We want, again, just to remind us, and I'll say this every time we have an opportunity to present here, is that we are centering communities of color, and specifically minoritized Black and Brown communities, in our work related to this executive order. Also knowing that with this work, we'll also, it is our intention to improve our law enforcement and criminal justice system. So on March 30th and 31st, respectively, you approved approximately 18 to 19 joint plans. And so these plans are inclusive of the collaborative, and what that means is the city and county initiatives, but also those county-only initiatives. And then also as part of this charge, we realized that we need support and we need staff to do this work, and so you also approved funding for the creation of the Community Justice Center. So the collaborative, to take us back to our history, is a combination of the City of Ithaca and Tompkins County, and we're also working with our partners on this, in this phase, the Center for Policing Equity. We often receive the question of, what does the Center for Policing Equity do and how do they support us in this work? Specifically, they support logistical and organizational content. Specifically, they have a robust staff that are able to help us organize things related to law enforcement-related activities. They're also able to help us to reach out to different types of community constituencies. They have a national, actually, if not international, presence in terms of law enforcement, so helping us connect to other communities that we ordinarily wouldn't have access to. Most of the folks who do work with CPE do have law enforcement background. Also, they help us provide research and data related to communities of color. And again, they also help us tell our story. So our progress update that we'll share with you today will be around the Community Justice Center, sequencing of the plans, and then also just to note that although the county did not vote on recommendation number one to redesign the City of Ithaca Police Department, I'd be remiss if not mentioning it, because that is the recommendation that I'm most asked about, and so want you to be aware and apprised of that work as well. In the City of Ithaca Working Group has convened, and then also the website and community engagement tool. Specifically, the Community Justice Center, we're in the process of two searches. We have a project director and a data analyst position. We opened positions originally for 30 days, and we had an applicant pool, but we wanted more applicants. And so we want to be able to bring to the community a robust pool of folks with lived experience that will support this work. And so we have sent out original invitations to city and county elected officials, staff, and community members to ensure that all parts of the community are recognized and are able to participate in the process. The search process will also include Q&A sessions with department heads and community members. And we've also reached out to community members to help facilitate that dialogue as well. So both searches have been extended through September 24th with the goal of hiring the project director first and then providing a couple of weeks where if we have some candidate names, then they would be allowed to participate or provide insight into the person that they would be supervising in the data analyst role. The question that I know you're going to ask me, what are you doing differently in this second round of searches than what you did in the first round? First thing we did was we looked at all of our posting again. We saw that we received a lot of clicks in certain areas, but certain folks didn't apply as eagerly as we might have hoped. And so we looked at some of our language in our postings against what we know is required. And so also knowing we're working with the civil service system, we're trying to meet the rules of the state, but then also meeting the rules of making sure that we are having it, we have equitable position descriptions. And so we changed some of the language and some of the degrees and things, and tried to open it up more to have to get a better understanding of and receive a broader application pool. We're also targeting some specific folks that folks have raised or elevated their names in the process as well, so that folks know we're out there and asking them for consideration. But in place, in terms of transparency, we don't know exactly who applies because the candidate pool is a redacted process, but we can reach out to folks and say, hey, you seem like you might be a good fit for this role, and we encourage folks to apply. So in addition to the search process and sending out those invitations and encouraging folks and working through that process, we've also been on a tour of city and county buildings and spaces specifically to identify where the CJC will be located. We are still identifying where the home will be. We have talked with folks at DSS. We've talked with folks at mental health. We've also talked with folks at the city, knowing that it'll probably be a county space, knowing that our
ITS staff have asked us to ensure that it's a county property due to system issues and system requirements. So we continue to do that work. We've also looked at the spaces, I believe on Tioga Street, I want to say, and so took a tour of some of those spaces as well. So we'll continue to do our work to identify a place that is will be where our candidates feel like they belong. So we're doing that. In addition to this, we've also sent out invitations for the subcommittee that will be leading the that will be supporting the CJC. And so we have started our sent out invitations for our short-term subcommittee. I know that we've asked, I know specifically here we've asked Rich from Public Safety and Shauna from Health and Human Services to serve in that capacity, knowing that many, a lot of the work that we do will interface between those two committees. And then from there, that short-term subcommittee will provide recommendations to this body. And then also then at that point, we will look for fuller, more robust feedback from the broader legislature on who should be appointed for these 1 to 2 year terms. Any questions? Okay. Please.
Yeah, thank you, Deanna. And thank you. Slow down.
I'm really breathing.
I know. I really appreciate it because I know how hard it is. I'm curious, you've extended this CJC staff search. Did we just not get enough applicants to really have a nice selection? Is that?
I would say, yes, to be honest, we want, so I want to use write the correct words because we do have some strong candidates there in the pool, but it's not enough to say that we've had a robust pool. So okay. Whoever's applied and folks who have been notified, we appreciate you, you know, continuing being a part. At the same time, we have invested in national recruitment areas, and so we want to see some of that pay off if we're able to do so.
Yeah, you just want as broad a pool as you can get. Okay.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Ben? Where we are is looking at the plan sequencing. When we refer to sequencing, we know that you've adopted myriad plans and they have to be implemented in a certain order. So we try to think about the most common themes and the things we heard most about in this work. And specifically, we're starting with the plans, but the city specifically is looking at the reimagination of IPD. Where they are right now, they're in the process of working with CPE and they have a working group that was appointed by the mayor that when they through the end of the year, on looking at the position redesign, naming conventions for the department, staffing levels, training, budget, all those different implications, and similar things that will apply to us, but in a different context. So that is the one of the first plans that we're releasing. Also, we're looking at the community healing plan as a place to launch because a lot of folks have historical trauma. And in looking at that trauma, it's difficult to move forward in these conversations if we don't acknowledge those things and build our community together. And so one of the things that we want to be sensitive to is the work and the experiences of minoritized folks in getting us to this place and how we've gotten here and then making sure they're acknowledged and they're a part of the healing process so we can move forward in implementing the entire process. In addition to looking at the community healing plan, we'll also be looking at the alternative response research. A lot of folks have either talked about incorporating greater mental health supports, looking at more outreach supports, and also we've also used the term community solutions officers. So what are the solutions that are needed in our community that will allow us to allow our armed officers to focus on those things where there is a severe and a significant threat? And so those are the three plans that we will start with, knowing that we will also include other plans. But knowing that based upon the themes of the research and the things that we've heard as well, these are the areas that we intend to start with. So each plan will start with significant rollout and announcement for each plan. And I think one of the biggest blessings that have happened to me since I've been here is just working with Dominic Recchio, who's our communications director. And so I don't say that lightly as in I think we work with a dynamic team here and just feel very, very fortunate. So I'll turn it over to him and to talk about the website and that this is something we will need all of you to be a part of. We'll need all of your support in getting this website launched.
Thanks, Deanna. I'm going to stop your sharing real quick and share my screen. And I feel very similarly about working with you. It's an absolute delight, and I think we get some great work done. So thank you. What I'm going to show you here is a very brief tour of the website that we've been talking about as both a website
and the community engagement tool. So you know, this will be announced widely to the public tomorrow, in conjunction with the city, for more public input, and has been shared with city and county staff. It's been shared with the city's working group, technical advisors, folks who have participated on focus groups, et cetera, with details of how to use it. So the brief overview I'll share with you is what this is designed to do and then how people can give input to reimagining public safety. As Deanna mentioned, each of the, I think there's about 24 between the city and county, total plans, each of those 24 plans will be uploaded to this site and announced when they're open for community input. That's this plans section here. So you can see all the different plans that we're working on at any given time or the ones that have already been completed in this section. What we're asking from the community is to submit their ideas and to interact with other people's ideas. So under each plan, for example here, the community healing plan to address trauma, there will be many ideas from the community. And then there'll be many comments, votes, and other reactions to those different ideas. It's kind of like its own social network under a plan. And then there's the news section. So we're constantly hearing from folks that they just don't have updates or know what's going on with the process. This will be our one-stop shop for all running updates about the plan. Every time we do a presentation like this, the short write-up about it and a link to the video will be on that news section of the site. And then this is the second part I'll focus on, just showing you what it allows us to do. I've talked about the input. That's the community's ideas and the conversation, the comments and reactions to those ideas. Internally, for county and city staff, it will allow us to sort of review all of those through a process. We can engage different experts on certain topics by reviewing them and keep a really thoughtful process. And then implementation. This will allow us to track along as we implement each of these ideas. And along the whole process, any member of the community is able to select something they're interested on the site and say, I'd like updates about this as it goes along, and it'll update people every time something new happens. So if I submit an idea, I'll show you here, I'll use the, there's one in here, so I'll use the city's implement an unarmed first responders unit plan. And I'll go to the ideas that have been submitted, and there are a few here, maybe a fender bender or an animal barking complaint. And I can go into this, and I can actually say I want updates on what happens for animal barking complaints. And I'll get updates throughout the entire process. So I'll stop there because I know you have a packed agenda, and there is a video with further instruction and information, and happy to answer any questions along with Deanna that you might have.
Great. Leslie?
Yes, thank you both for the presentation. It's really exciting. I know folks have been waiting to hear, so I think that you'll get a lot of response. One question about that response is moderating and facilitating some of that conversation to make sure it's helpful for folks and it stays in the positive and forward-moving direction. How do you guys have a plan for that?
I would say the county does have some guidelines in terms of web content, and so we try to adhere to those things, but also recognizing there are certain spaces where people are blowing off steam and understanding that without being disrespectful to one another, and I think that's what you're getting at. And so we try to list those things anytime we have a public forum or anytime we're doing anything where we know there'll be community engagement. And so, Dom, you may have more feedback, but I know that those are the guidelines that we typically adhere to.
Oh, yeah, I would just clarify that the guidelines are the social media policy that the county has, which needs updating and is on our agenda to do so at some point. But there are guidelines there to look at. And also there are going to be some where we know it might be more sensitive, where we will allow for confidential ideas to be shared directly with working group members or groups tasked with or the community justice center for that. So there are some areas where more maybe that blowing off steam might be in a more confidential manner, mm-hmm. or sharing of a personal experience might be in a more confidential manner.
So here's an example, Leslie. So if you on using the plan, there are certain plans where you can vote on certain things. But in the healing plan, because of the sensitive nature, we don't have voting in that space, you know, in the same way that we would. We may at some point, but the way we're setting it up, we want people to feel open to communicate their ideas. And then also, most ideas, we have the setting turned on where anybody can see it. You can see what's happening. Again, knowing that we're moderating, we get updates and alerts as system administrators on what's happening on the site. And so we try to be agile to the process and what's required and being thoughtful in that we want to make sure that the things arise from the work.
So I will add, you know, I think I hear where you're going, Leslie, and as much as we try, like you said, to be agile, to be positive, to, you know, share what our guidelines or social media, you know, there probably will be people out there who will say things that, you know, could be taken as egregious, things that will be hurtful and, you know, some in some respects discriminatory. I will say Dominic has done an amazing job at capturing and removing some of those things in other forms that we've had and figuring out ways to not allow for, you know, those comments to show up because some of them have been, you know, very ugly. So in whatever ways that you all will monitor that, I'm confident that you'll be able to continue. So thank you. All right. Anything else from you, Deanna or Dominic?
I would just say to Leslie, sometimes while we try to monitor a part of the, I would say that my goal is to work myself out of a job in that discrimination and harassment don't exist. And so a part of how we do this, and I think Leslie said this to me in such a way that's kind of stuck with me, and it's not that I'm trying to get your jacket tonight, by the way, is that how do we take those things down? How do we move the content? But also how do we share that with the legislature? And how do we share the information with you all to speak to the real things that are happening in our community? And so that folks all are being able to tell that story. Because once we wipe things away, sure, we don't want folks especially calling out a staff and things of that, shifting that nature. But we do receive those types of things that do happen. So one of the things that I'm always thinking about is how much do we want to share, you know, in a way that is trending, or is this a one-time circumstance? And so I fully expect that there will be hate speech because there is hatred in the world. And so, and as unfortunate as it is, we will try to contain it the best we can, but at the same time, we will elevate it to you and share it with Lisa as well and our leaders in a way that helps inform our decision-making.
Thank you for that. I mean, we're not trying to censor anybody, but we certainly don't want, you know, people to be threatening others and so on and so forth. Any other questions on this as we move forward? I do have one other quick question, or two quick questions. One is, did we, when we submitted our plan to the governor's office as was requested, did we ever get something back, some response, some direction? I don't remember hearing anything about it.
Jason got one email back, an automatic reply from the email address at the budget director's office. Right. And that was all that I understand we've gotten back from the state since.
Right, I remember that. I just wondered if there was something else that said, you know, is a good plan, move forward, change this. There was nothing.
Nothing additional.
Okay. Shauna? Oh, my second question had to do with who was the gorgeous model lady in the first page on that slide. I just wanted to embarrass her a little bit. Go ahead, Shauna.
I was just wondering, is the $7.8 million of OTRs, does the Reimagining Public Safety, is that included in the 7.8?
Yes.
Lisa smiles.
Yes.
Well, that's a positive.
We attempted to ensure that, you know, the county does have a process, and also we know that you're also looking at things with ARP funds, and so we, Lisa was really great about making sure that each plan was methodically aligned
with the department or listed in the process, and so you may see an OTR in human resources related to training. You may see an OTR in county admin related to the CJC, and so we tried to meet. I didn't realize how much business the county did until the budget process started. Now I'm much more aware, and so you'll see all of the OTARs run through this. And also, more importantly, when we met with the mayor today, I made sure that reminded him that he owes 50%.
Good. Good, good, good. All right. And I think next up is our COVID report. I'm looking at the time. 15 minutes. Is that enough time before we take a break? Dominic is nodding. All right, let's just jump right into it. So I know we had a packed agenda tonight, and so I appreciate your patience. Take a stretch.
Get some water.
You can take a one more minute stretch. I'm trying to find it.
All right, thank you, Deanna. Such a stressful job, but the public health director looks all calm and smiling and fresh.
Amy and Dominic and Jay really do all the work.
Maybe, I was just about to say, maybe you take a break now and then come back, but here we go.
All right. I will get us started on our regular update of COVID response. You can see how long this has been going on for. I was actually surprised today when I saw the April 7th date. So
we need to.
Oh, is that better?
No.
Hmm.
Whatever that magic thing is that Dominic said, Ruth, you're supposed to do
from beginning
presentation mode or something like that.
You have multiple screens, Amy?
I do. What do I need to?
Is it presenting on one of those multiple screens?
It is.
Is there the little one that shows your notes on another screen? Nope. You might just need to try it again.
Maybe you can uncheck use presenter view. Would that help? Up there on the right.
Hold on just a second. Let me stop sharing for just a minute. Is that better?
No. Yeah.
There you go.
Need it. There we go. Three screens is too many. So here is the August 18th to September 7th data. We're starting the theme this time is our college return and our cases continued to rise. You can see here that we had 354 active cases since last time we met. Importantly, though, the hospitalization has remained fairly low. We have had, unfortunately, two additional deaths that are COVID-related, so there's some mixed news in that piece. There has been still some vaccine going out, not as high as before, but we knew that would slow down. There's been some new changes within the executive orders. One is the reason that you're meeting remotely. There's been a review, continuation, and expiration of prior orders, as well as some state legislation signed to extend remote meetings. Within that first executive order, there was also the mask mandate for schools, and I know Frank will probably talk more about our K-12 school systems. We've had a lot of communications, a lot of things rolling out from the health department, as well as others, information about the Pfizer full approval, alerting about the high transmission rate here in Tompkins County, as well as guidance for mask wearing in schools. We discussed a lot about the case increase and what that means for our community. As Dan mentioned earlier, we reached out to hire more response team members and have had successful recruitment so far. In finding additional team members to join us. Also in our partnership area, there's been some changes on the campuses. Cornell moved their alert level to yellow, asking for masking outdoors on campus. They also increased testing. We've also issued some clarifying guidance for those who are fully vaccinated individuals exposed to a positive case. The hours. Again, this is regular hours and overtime hours. You can see the difference in pay as well as comp time. That's the equivalent of dollars earned. We have still available the Families First Coronavirus Response Act leave. And so here are where our employees have taken this benefit. And then some increase in COVID-related expenses. The primary change, which were up $26,000 as of September 3rd, is in our contract staffing. So as I mentioned, we have increased staffing. Moving on, I'm going to pass it over to Frank to talk you through the next few slides.
Great. Thanks, Amy, and good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
This first slide is our standard prevalence slide, and I spent a little time on this evening. As you can see, as Amy described earlier, we saw a pretty precipitous climb over the last few weeks as our case numbers have gone up. We were getting close to 500 cases as recently as a few days ago. The good news is that has started to peak and come down. Tomorrow morning we'll be reporting 313 active cases, so down almost 200 from our peak. So that's the good news. What we saw in those numbers was it was predominantly related to higher ed. We certainly had community cases in there similar to what we were seeing prior to higher ed returning to the community. But the dramatic increase was because we found so many positive higher ed students. And that was really due to Cornell's testing protocols. They had reentry testing, and then more importantly, they began surveillance testing of all students vaccinated or not. And that really jumped the cases up pretty dramatically. You'll also see that the vaccination rate of our positive cases jumped up pretty dramatically. But all things, quite honestly, we thought we might see. I'll be honest, I did not think we were going to get close to 500. But we were talking back midsummer when things were looking really good with, you know, one and two or zero cases a day, that we did expect that once we started to reengage in new activities, we would start to see cases rise again. And so that has happened. What we're really shifting now is our focus on what measures are really telling the story about COVID in our community. And while we've been looking at case numbers throughout the pandemic, and certainly we continue to monitor them as we go forward, we're really looking at now at the severity of illness. We should be focusing on what's happening with our hospitals and what our hospitalization numbers look like. So even as we peaked with more cases than we've ever had before, our hospitalizations have remained in single digits, and that's really the important thing. So the vaccine is having its intended effect. We have breakthrough cases, and we know that even if you're vaccinated, you can get COVID and you can transmit COVID. But what we also know is that the likelihood that you'll have a severe reaction to COVID is also significantly less if you're fully vaccinated. So we're in this kind of transition period, and I know there's been a lot of interest in what we should be doing and should we be doing things differently. And really what we're doing at this point is we're transitioning from pandemic to endemic, in that eradication really isn't possible for a lot of reasons. It has to do with our behavior here in the United States. It has to do with the ability to get mass vaccinations across the globe. And really what we've done is we've transitioned to a point where COVID is now going to be part of our disease profile going forward. And we have to begin to understand what that means for our community in the long term. And so that really takes us back to what measures we're focusing on. And as I said, it really is the hospitalizations and severe illness. But we still have to take precautions. And really those precautions have to be focused on the most vulnerable. And those are those that are unable to be vaccinated, particularly right now, children. and those that are immunocompromised, right? So when we're talking about different steps that we should be taking, we're focusing on those environments. So it was great to see that the governor instituted across the board mask mandates for pre-K through 12 for everyone, whether vaccinated or not, because that's going to add a layer of protection. There's also now a testing requirement for pre-K through 12 that we're in the process of working with our schools to put plans together to make that testing available for their staff and the students. So a lot of effort going into seeing what happens with that particular population. Obviously, tomorrow's a big day for them. So that's kind of the next hurdle after we saw summer travel kind of push our numbers up. Then we saw higher ed returning kind of push our numbers up. The next thing that we're looking to is pre-K through 12 and what that might look like. So we still have precautions in place for them, albeit not as stringent as they were last school year. And it's an effort to make sure we can get kids back to school because we know there are negative effects on them from not being in school, and really trying to see what might schools look like in this new environment. If something dramatic happens, obviously, as we have throughout the pandemic, we'll work with our school districts to adapt to it. But right now, I think our districts have done a great job putting plans in place to prepare for the students to return and return as safely as possible. All right, let's move on to the next one, Amy. So positive cases by vaccination status. As I mentioned, the dark blue, which is the fully vaccinated, you can see it spiked up. And most of our cases here locally were in vaccinated individuals. Obviously, the higher education population influences that because they are having 90%+ vaccination rates because of their requirements. And so it's not unexpected in a population that heavily vaccinated that you would see our cases be that way. I would expect over time that will start to settle out. What we do know is that we're a bit of an outlier from that extent when you look around the rest of New York and the rest of the country, that it is still fairly uncommon for vaccinated people to test positive. It happens, but it's not at the rates that we're seeing it here locally. So just as we did when things were good last year and our numbers were better than everywhere around us, we were continually pointing out that, you know, just because it's that way here doesn't mean that it couldn't be different based on what we're seeing in other places. So same as now, things are not, you know, what we would have hoped to see them, but we need to look at the larger picture to understand how the disease is actually working. So we're still confident in our position that vaccines are safe and effective, and they are our best way to limit the severity of illness if someone contracts COVID. Vaccination progress, this is still, Amy alluded to this, we're still, you know, chugging away at it, you know, a person here, a person there, 10 people, 20 people there, have clinics scheduled throughout the month, and so we're going to keep vaccinating folks, but we're, you know, our progress has slowed dramatically. Amy, next slide. So age range, we're getting into the demographic data that we show you regularly. Since July 1 through yesterday, as you can see, both the 10 to 19 and 20 to 29 age range spiked, right? And that really accounts for what we were seeing in our higher ed population as they returned to the community. All right, race, similar. Things are moving a little bit. Again, our numbers are so small that it's hard to really draw any conclusions, but what we have seen is those identifying as other has gone up pretty significantly. Same with ethnicity. Things are, you know, they're moving a little bit, but I don't know that we can make any, you know, real correlations because our numbers are still relatively small. But we do continue to monitor it, and we are working continually with our public information folks to try to reach all of our populations in our community.
And I can talk a little bit about this slide. This is just our testing at the Kiga Health Services sampling site. And so you can see there has been a spike in testing over the past 3 weeks, really four or five overall. But we continue to have about 30% of those cases, 30 to 40% are the ones that don't have insurance that need assistance from the county. So your investment there continues to go a far ways away. And we have seen some FEMA reimbursement on these costs. I don't have that in front of me tonight, but we will be discussing it soon as we look at our own testing program, as well as the opportunity to provide testing to other Tompkins County municipalities and their municipal employees. So we'll have more discussions about that at future, I believe, Budget Capital Personnel Committee meeting. And that is the end of our show. So,
questions? Rich?
Thanks, Amy and Frank. I'm curious, it seems like your data is really influenced by the amount of testing done by the university and perhaps Ithaca College. Is there any assumption to be drawn about what's happening in the non-student community where testing is not so prevalent? If there was similar testing, would we see similar numbers of asymptomatic people that are infected?
Yeah, it's a good question, Rich. Our testing on that last slide that Amy shows has gone up pretty dramatically over the last few weeks. As you know, as there's more cases, I think it drives people to seek out testing. To some degree, we have an idea of what the disease prevalence is based on the numbers, and they went up a little bit starting the middle to end of July and have kind of consistently been about the same level, even though our numbers peaked pretty dramatically when the students came in. So we kind of have a baseline now of between 25 and 35 community-based cases that we've been seeing. Some days it's less than that, but generally speaking, that's where we are. I think your point is a good one. And the thing with testing people from a surveillance perspective is you're going to find asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic positives, right? And I think that's a large part of what we saw with the student population. We definitely saw spread happening within the student population. But you also have to remember, once you test positive, we don't tell people to get tested again for at least 90 days. Because there can be remnants of the virus still in your body. And so there may have been some of those students that were positive and recovered before they even came back to the campus, but because of the surveillance testing, tested positive subsequent to a previous exposure. So we don't know everything about all of the cases, but we can make some conclusions. And I think we're starting to see, we've identified those that had the virus. We've done isolation and quarantine, so the student numbers are beginning to drop off. And like I said, pre-K through 12 would be the next challenge. But I think generally speaking, our community now has a baseline of a handful of cases. And that's part of what we have to just continue to monitor, but at the same time be looking at, you know, what ends up being the severity of that illness in our community as we're making decisions.
I had a follow-up, if I could. I had a second question, Frank. It seems like one of the bright spots in this report is the number of hospitalizations is really, really low. And certainly, it seems like vaccination plays a big part of that. But I'm also wondering if you could just comment on the effectiveness of treatment. I would assume that since the spring of 2020, our doctors and healthcare professionals have just gotten dramatically better at treating it. Is that the case?
Yeah, absolutely. We know more about the disease. There are more interventions available, particularly at the hospital level. The monoclonal antibodies, there's a program locally to make that available to certain priority populations. So, yes, the vaccine is a big part of it, but it's one piece of the puzzle, including our ability to treat people more effectively.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Rich. I have Shauna, Leslie, Dan, and Mike Lane.
Hi, this question is for Amy. I was wondering, I know that during HHS we discussed FEMA reimbursement for municipalities, and I know that you were still looking into
to that last time we checked. Whenever there is an answer or response, is there a way to communicate that with the municipalities?
Yes. What we'll do is reach out to them. We have biweekly municipal calls with all the elected officials, letting them know about our testing program and that we've looked into this potential as we continue our contract with Keuka Health Systems, that if we do that, we can look at the program, including municipal employees throughout the county. And so that is actually the contract that we'll be working on. That extension and resolution will be flowing through your committees in the near future.
Thank you.
Leslie.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to bring to your attention, I'm sure you're aware, but I've heard from many community members concerns about the ability to get tested on the weekend. And given the rise in case numbers, as well as the need to make sure that we continue surveillance testing and that anyone who feels ill can get tested without waiting 3 days and, you know, potentially mixing with folks in between, I'm wondering what we're doing about that. And I wanted to also know how it's going with working with the school systems, as I asked last time.
So we've had some conversations with the hospital about it potentially expanding weekend hours at the mall. As you can imagine, with everything healthcare these days, it's all contingent on finding the appropriate staffing. So they are working, and we're hopeful that there will be an announcement relatively soon. But they're just not able to make that announcement yet because they're still working to operationalize it. But it is being worked on actively to try to find a solution for that weekend testing. The question about the schools, I think things are going well. Tomorrow's the big day for most of them. We met this morning to talk about some potential opportunities. There's a new federal program for testing that will be free to school districts to access for surveillance testing of asymptomatic individuals. We continue to work with BOCES to set up a program with the funding that we received. Well, we haven't received it yet, but the funding that was promised to us for symptomatic children in the schools to make sure that parents don't have barriers to getting tested, that the child can be tested at school before they get sent home if they arrive symptomatic or become symptomatic during the day. As far as the guidance, the state is really driving that. And they are talking directly to the districts. And so I don't generally have any insight for them beyond, you know, just trying to help interpret guidance wherever it's appropriate. But I think all of our districts have taken this seriously. Masking will be universal as it's required to be. I think some of our districts, if not all of them, are going to be having outdoor masking in many situations. So I think there's a lot of effort going into trying to provide a safe environment for the kids as they return to school.
Dan?
Fine. You mentioned about shifting attention to not so much positive cases, but how sick people are in hospitalizations. And I wanted to ask a little more about this because the large number of Cornell students that are making up or college students that are making up the statistics at this point are almost all vaccinated and they almost never have serious sickness associated with it. So when people see those numbers, it's not... The conversations I have a lot are people see these high numbers and they're concerned. And I say, well, you're vaccinated, so and you're not going to get very sick. So my question is to you, Frank, are we tracking that in some way? Is there a way to measure that? The people that are sick, whatever that means, vaccinated versus unvaccinated?
Yes. So we know... we know the vaccination status of those that are in the hospital, and I believe we've been reporting that in some form. I'm sorry if I'm getting that wrong, but Yeah, I know we have because we've talked about it publicly. We have certainly seen some people vaccinated in the hospital. There's no doubt about that. But generally speaking, those folks have underlying health conditions that any respiratory illness that they might have encountered may likely have resulted in them ending up in the hospital. So the numbers are small enough that we are tracking it almost on a case-by-case basis to make sure, you know, we understand what's happening with those that are ending up being most sick. I think one of the challenges that remains is we're talking about a handful of people. So it's hard to draw any real conclusions from our local experience. So we still have to, you know, continue to look more broadly about that. And I would also point out that, remember, when we report our hospitalization numbers, those are the numbers of people in Cuyahoga Medical Center. They're not all Tompkins County residents. So what you're seeing from our hospitalization rates, not only are they low, but they are representative of almost a regional hospitalization between us and Schuyler predominantly, because that's where CMC has their affiliation. So we are looking at it on a case-by-case basis and trying to share that information as best we can. Sometimes we're still hampered by wanting to protect people's privacy, but I do think we're tracking it and sharing when we can.
Is there, so when someone says to me that, you know, they're worried about these high numbers, and I say to them, you're vaccinated, your odds are very, very good. Is there a statistic I can point to help me make that case to them?
Yeah, so I think the CDC just put out a new study yesterday or today that shows you're 17 times less likely to have a severe reaction to COVID if you're vaccinated. So that's just a raw number that they're sharing based off of the, you know, the national experience related to COVID. That probably is a better indicator than looking at just our four or five cases that are in our local hospital.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you, Frank. Mike Lean, and then Martha.
Hi, Frank. My question has to do with thinking about the kids going back to school, and the very youngest children, of course, are not vaccinated. Do we expect that at some point they will be able to be vaccinated? And if so, what does it take for the CDC to recommend that?
Yeah, so there are ongoing studies and trials related to the younger children. As you can imagine, it takes longer. Because we want to make sure that the effects on a young developing child are similar to an adult and are safe before they are offered the vaccine. So I know it's actively being looked at, and it's probably the question we get the most. I just don't know when we might see that. The most common I don't want to call it a rumor because that's probably not the right word, but the most common time frame that's being thrown around is the beginning of 2022 when we might see some approvals for the younger children to be able to be vaccinated.
Thank you. Martha, last word.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Farm workers, Frank, I know in the last spring, you did a lot of outreach to farm workers, and I wondered if that's being done again. It may be a whole different group of people than come through the state in the spring. Is that something we're doing again?
Yeah, it's a good question, Martha. I don't know that we've done anything recently, particularly with that group, other than to know that we have community partners that are very in tune to those populations. And in fact, they were the ones that did the heavy lifting to get those populations vaccinated last go around. And so, you know, if they were telling us, hey, we've got people that are unvaccinated, we need to get vaccinated, we certainly would look to support those efforts. Vaccine is pretty readily available. You can walk into almost any pharmacy at this point and get vaccinated, as well as, you know, with healthcare providers. So many of those populations are served by federally qualified health centers that I know have access to vaccine as well. So the long answer is we haven't really specifically heard anything about it, but I definitely trust if our partners that serve those populations felt there was a need, they would let us know.
Okay. All right. Thanks. I have a question about, I try to follow as much of the science as I can keep up with. Do you know how the process of mutation of, you know, of new variants, is that any more or less likely in a vaccinated population than unvaccinated? In other words, does being vaccinated reduce the percent, the likelihood of new mutations arising? Or is it
Yeah.
you have infection?
Yeah, I'm not a virologist, so I don't want to try to be too specific, other than to know that the more transmission that occurs, the more likelihood that mutation can happen, because every time it enters a new host, it has an opportunity to evolve. I think generally speaking, we still believe that transmission rates amongst vaccinated individuals is lower than amongst the unvaccinated population. So from that perspective, having a fully vaccinated population certainly has an impact on limiting the evolution of new variants. I think the important thing to remember is we're a worldwide community. We're not just New York, Tompkins County, or the U.S. even. And so it really matters about what's happening around the world. And there are still large swaths of the planet that don't have access to vaccine. And so as long as that is occurring, the chances for mutations to happen and then come to us in many of the same ways that it did the first time still exist.
Okay. The reason I ask is that I worry about being too sanguine, about being too comfortable with vaccinated people getting infected because, well, you're not likely to get sick, or you're not going to get very sick. I obviously that's a comfort to those of us who are vaccinated, but I worry that, that just as important as being vaccinated is the continued effort to mask and distance and keep people from transmitting, even if we're vaccinated. And because I worry that, you know, what we're all worried about is the next variant might outrun the vaccines altogether and we'll be back to last March. So I am nervous about feeling I'm nervous about feeling too good about the fact that we have people who are positive but not very sick. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's better than if they're sick. But I think the real goal is to keep people from transmitting and from being positive, from getting disease at all. Am I wrong about that?
No, I don't think you're wrong. I think there are variables that play into that conversation. And the one that we really don't spend a lot of time talking on is the negative impacts of some of the public health restrictions that we've had over the last year on our other life, you know, our other health by delaying healthcare, not having access to it, our mental health, development of our children by not being in person in school. And so really, as the public health director, those all things are important to me as well. And so when we're looking at this from a public health perspective, yes, we're certainly concerned about future variants and what those might look like and what might happen. But that happens with a lot of other diseases that evolve because of transmission that we address when we see them. We take steps to try to limit their spread, but we don't shut down or do mass public health efforts in order to try to quell them completely. So we're in this transition place where we're not fully endemic yet, right? But we're also at a point where the idea that we're going to eradicate this really isn't a reality anymore. And so we're just trying to focus our attention on those that are most vulnerable and keep protections there until we can see how this evolves as we move forward. But ultimately, we have to get back to whatever normal is as much as possible. And we're doing that in kind of a stepwise fashion at this point, in hopes that we will keep the disease under as much control as we can, that it will limit the severity of disease, but we will get back to business. People will get back to work. Kids will get back to school. All of those things that will help deal with all of those other social determinants of health that have been exacerbated over the last 2.5 or 2 years now. So it's really a balance. You're not wrong, but we're looking to balance, you know, across all of the issues, what makes the most sense to protect our community as a whole.
Okay. Thanks very much, Frank, and to everybody. Thanks.
Okay. Sigler?
My question is along the same lines, Frank, and I don't know if you can answer it or not. I mean, the shift to endemic is actually, that's a pretty big shift. But I have to admit, I mean, I watched the college football crowds this weekend, and I never knew the crowds were that big. So clearly, it's unbelievable. But 100,000 people, and I didn't see a lot of masks. So I guess it's interesting that we're making that shift. My question for you is, you know, my kid just got off the soccer field like an hour ago, and she's wearing a mask outside playing. Is there a number that we need to hit for, like, the mask mandates to go away? Are we looking at 50? Are we not looking at 50? And then what happens if the next variant happens? Do we do all this again? I guess that's my question. I don't know if you can answer any of that. So.
Yeah, no, it's a good question, Mike, and it comes up a lot with the schools. And it is interesting, and I mentioned this to the team, you know, in our community, the response to this is almost polar opposite to everyone around us, where our community is asking, why aren't we doing more? Why don't we have more mandates? And pretty much everyone around us is like, you want us to do what? We're over this kind of thing. So we're kind of in this middle ground with it. And I think what we're trying to figure out is what makes sense. Schools in this environment with this new density level is a new thing within the time of COVID for us. So we're trying to give a little bit to get the kids back in school while at the same time not taking all of the guidance away that could potentially be a protection. As far as the sports component of it, quite honestly, the letter of the guidance from NYSED and the CDC is, in a high transmission area, you should cancel high risk sports. Right? That's the letter of the guidance. Our school districts have not chosen to do that. Neither have, I think, any in all of New York State. But they are looking to make sure they have enough protections in place as they go forward to see how things go. And I think a large part, Mike, as far as when that would change, a lot of it has to do with vaccination. Right. We want to make sure that all the kids have an opportunity to be vaccinated and be protected before we go too far removing those restrictions. And then really, if we see in 2 or 3 months that there's still no transmission in school settings like we saw last year in this new environment, then we'll be talking about, what do we reduce? What public health restrictions can we walk back a little bit now that we have some experience under our belt with the density piece kind of going away? Let's keep the mask, see how that goes, and then, you know, kind of move on from there.
Thank you all for your questions, Frank. It's interesting, you know, you talk to one set of people, they want mandates, you talk to another set, they don't want any mandates, and somewhere in the middle is that decision-making. So thank you all for all that you're doing. Thank you very much, Frank, Amy, Dominic, and the whole team, for your continued work on this. And for informing us. Thank you, Deanna, Dominic, and the team, for your work on reimagining public safety. Everybody is so busy. We really appreciate it, and again, for informing us. And thank you, Lisa, for that budget bomb that you call a heads up that you just dropped on us. We appreciate it, and we look forward to the process. We know our employees do matter. I'm jokingly saying that, but we know our employees always take time to be mindful about what they're asking for so that they can do the business of the county and serve our community well. If there is nothing else for Frank or Amy, Lisa, it might have to wait. We are going to take a break. Yep. Let's go to county attorney. Is there anything from you, Jonathan?
Well, Kathy had asked me to talk about voting, but you've already voted. But I'd probably say a few words about it. You know, as you know, before when everybody was appearing remotely, we did roll call voting. and the issue came up of how we should vote. And it comes up sort of again in now that we're sort of a hybrid. Under the law, we still have to have, you know, we must record the vote. So it needs to be clear to people watching how everybody votes. And the issue had come up before is that, you know, well, we have to do some kind of roll call, but would it be okay to do a short form? And I always thought, particularly then with everybody not there, you do a short form roll call, you have two people who are recorded as their vote. And then to ask you, you know, is anybody recorded as no vote? And then there are, you know, other than the chair herself, there are 11 people out there, which the chair would have to kind of make sure what their vote is, maybe on two or three different screens. And it'd be pretty difficult, a real burden on the chair. I think the same thing is probably true. We don't know going in how many legislators may be there or may not be. And also, we don't know how many other people are there. So we don't know whether it's going to be on one screen or two screens, or even three. So while it's still legally possible to do like a short form, I think the burden on the chair, it could be great depending on how many people are there, both how many legislators are there and how many are not there, plus how many other people are there in order to see how people voted or not. And it seems like the full roll call seems to work okay. So I still recommend going with that. That's obviously already had one vote already. But obviously it came up again because of the change back to at least optional to, you know, for legislators to be there or not be there, as well as the public. So I'd be happy to answer any questions, but I didn't have any other report.
Thank you. Thanks, Jonathan.
Thanks, Dr. Grayson. All right, our next director, Rick Schneider. Good evening. I'd like to my screen and share with you the contingency report right up to date, and then share with you July's sales tax numbers. You should be looking at the contingency report right now. And we started with $1.9 million. That's here at the top of the screen. And these are all the resolutions that the legislature adopted throughout the year. There have been a few big ones, three or four that were in the six figures. We had a $300,000 one for health COVID testing. We had a $144,000 resolution in the middle of the year for creating community justice center. We had a $573,000 one for room tax increases to the STPB and CBB. And the other big ones were $126,000 for the 3-year workforce career development program. And most recently, $218,000 for our HR payroll migration project led off by our ITS department. So when you add all these uses of funds out of the $1.9 million that we had, we'd have spent $1,767,000. That leaves a balance of $132,775. And I might add that with the contingency fund resolutions at this meeting tonight, we're probably going to use that. So I would recommend going forward to county administration, much like we did last year, I believe it was the same time of year, that we come up with another contingency allotment. Last year, we allotted an extra $1 million, almost $1.1 million. I don't think we need that much to get through this year, but probably about $600,000. I would like to see a resolution come forth from county admin that would supplant the contingency fund another $600,000 to allow us to make contingency allocations throughout the end of the year. Like I said, we only have $133,000 left. So I'll take questions on this before I go into sales tax.
Rick, I don't know if Leslie can see it now.
I'm sorry, do you want it back?
Okay, you had said something about, like, I think the 300-something thousand for COVID testing. Is that something we'll get reimbursed for?
I believe so. I think most of the COVID testing that we've, I mean, Amy and Lisa might be able to speak to it. This was to appropriate money into the health department so we would have the money in the expense account to pay for it. I think most of that is anticipated to come back at 100% through FEMA funding. Perhaps Lisa or Amy could chime in if that's correct.
That's correct, Rick. Everything should be reimbursed through FEMA. FEMA is delayed some. Obviously, we've talked about that, so it's not immediate. We hope that it's in the same year, but I can't guarantee that.
Right.
Okay, so it's sort of, and if it comes in, does it go back in the contingent fund, or is it? Okay. All right, thank you.
Ashley.
Thank you. Thanks, Rick. Good points, Martha. I'm also wondering, you know, you're projecting 600K, we're into September. What are you expecting to come? Are there known issues that you think are going to be coming that are going to need to be funded?
No, I really don't have a handle on that. I know that in most years we start to gear up and have a lot more from September through the end of the year, so that we're going into our heavy use of contingency. Obviously, contingency, you don't know where you're going to be short till you get to the last third of the year, and that's when accounts are already depleted. So I would say we have a pretty heavy season of contingency uses ahead of us through October, November, December, and that's why I'm recommending maybe $600,000 to come out of general. It would be a budget adjustment, taking out a general fund balance and putting it into the contingency account for the legislature to continue to make contingency approvals throughout the remainder of the year.
And you don't anticipate that any of the mid-cycle requests to date would offset that difference?
Are you saying, can I change my estimate based on what we've seen so far?
Right. Yep.
I can't. Last year was such an aberration. And the year before was a pretty standard year. Typically, we get through the year with this kind of funding. I mean, usually we have $900,000 or $1 million in contingency. This year we had 1.9 because we were coming out of COVID. And I'll allow, you know, the county administration to come up with whatever number they might have a better handle on what the best guess number is. For all I know, they might have 300,000-400,000 appropriations that they know are going to be made by the end of the year, which would blow my theory out of the water, right? There's 1.2 million. I don't know specifically what departments are going to turn in at this point in time. Last year we had just finished, Jason had just finished making the departments do, mid-year budget adjustments across the board. The departments never had to do that before, and that was a pretty long and involved process. But after we got through those mid-year budget adjustments, which was decreasing departmental budgets significantly, the contingency requests still continued, but not at the volume or not at the high rate that we thought it would be. That's why when we put in $1.1 million last year at this time, we only ended up spending $600,000. So whatever number you put there, it's probably going to be used. But again, it's a guessing game. I just think add something there.
All right. Keep going, Rick.
Okay. We'll go into sales tax. Share the screen. Okay, you should be looking at sales tax for July. Do you see that on the screen? It's also page 7 and 8 in your agenda packet. For the month of July, we had another really good month, coming in at 20.28% higher than last year, just for the month of July. And moving to the right-hand column, year-to-date, for the county portion, you can see that our year-to-date was $22,418,000 compared to $18,508,000, which was a 21.13% increase year-to-date. At the bottom of the sheet, you can see that we are at 64% or 62%, depending on which method that you use. We only needed to be at 58% to meet budget for 7/12 of the year. So we're ahead of budget here, whether you look at the gross budget or if just that unit 999 unallocated sales tax revenue budget. Both of those numbers are good. The graph, which you like, which is included in your packet, it's pretty squirrely when it trends so close. Rich John asked this question last time. How can it be mimicking or mirroring what we did in the purple was 2019. The red is 2021. And it's uncanny how it's just so indexed that we are getting. But down below the chart here, you can see 2019 compared to 2020 compared to 2021. And we're even above, obviously we're above 2020 and we are even above 2019. So again, the increase year over year is $3.9 million. And we should all be pretty happy with that for seven twelfths of the year having gone by. Any questions on sales tax?
Yes. 20 point something percent is not enough. What are you doing about it? I'm kidding. Rich.
Thanks, Rick. And again, if you look at that graph, really since July a year ago, the numbers are tracking. And statistically, that just seems impossible. It's good we've gotten a fair amount of money from New York State, but going into budget season, I don't think we can take our sales tax numbers as a true indicator of economic activity in our community. And that's really, I find, a scary thought. I don't think we can look at the sales tax numbers as an indication of recovery. You know, I hesitate to say that New York State is having us on, but I think these numbers can't be accurate. You know, I mean, it's good we're getting the cash, and you know, it'll help us with our 2021 budget. But I don't know what this is really telling us for where we're actually at. I'd love to have one of my colleagues say, no, Rich, you've missed something significant here going into budget season, and we can rely on this as, to help us figure out what is going to happen going forward.
I think Mike's about to.
Okay.
I can only give you my opinion, Rich, but I think it's the internet sales that we didn't have back then, the sales tax from those.
But they wouldn't be the same as 2019. There's too many data points that are too close. It looks like somebody in Albany is saying, here's what the 2019 numbers were. Yeah, we're going to send them something very similar.
I think internet sales have, I tend to agree with Mike.
But that would
people have been home. People have been, there's been a lot of that happening.
But if that's the case, you wouldn't see the tracking, because it's a totally different source of revenue.
That's true.
Internet sales versus store sales. I don't have a good explanation. It just scares me that I don't know what we can draw from this information or rely on.
All right.
That's when Jason used to say that you have to look at over the long run, like 8 or 10 year period, and draw your lines, average lines that mitigate the aberrations fairly straight over an 8 to 10 year period, and then make broader average assumptions about like 3 or 4 year periods. Like you're going to have, and I think what the state has done and what Jason has done in the past, and probably Lisa too at this point in her budget, she already gave away so many parts of her budget tonight that I'm disappointed. There's maybe next week when she'll have the magic sales tax formula for us to see. But I know that we used to average sales tax over multiple year period. That's how they came out with that generic 3 to 3.5%, sometimes 4% growth over a year as an average over a 10 or 11 year period. But you can't really slice and dice it much finer than that. Only come up with what a average is over a long period of time. And that's to be fiscally conservative.
Thank you, Rich. Thanks, Rick, and thanks, Rich, for your hesitation around it. I hear you. Shauna, did you have a?
Yeah, I definitely think that we have different revenue sources right now. For example, one of our main streams was automobile sales. And right now, places like McGuire, who used to have 1,000 cars on their lot, have 26 cars. They just don't have the inventory. And so, you know, my guess is one of our biggest revenue streams has somewhat dried up. And so I think you're right, Mike. I think there is something to the internet sales because it would have to fill the gap where our automobile tax revenue is coming from.
And gas and fuel prices having gone up so much has also filled in a gap as far as being potential increases in our sales tax. So as unpleasant as it is, it still is a positive on our sales tax.
All right.
Okay.
Martha has a question.
Oh.
Yeah, I also think we shouldn't forget that we have a really cyclical population. We have almost a third of our population that kind of comes and leaves the county at very regular times during the year, you know, aside from the pandemic. So I agree with the idea of looking at that kind of a graph and map a bunch of years on top of each other would be really interesting to see. I think there's just a strong trend because of our higher education population.
Thank you all. Let's not forget just the inflated prices for stuff as well.
True.
That's out there too, in a big way. All right. Anything
thank you
else
very
for
much.
You, Rick?
That is all for me. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. I'm just going to back up for a quick minute and ask if you all received your email from Brittany this afternoon for the special legislature meeting on September 15th at 4:30. Thank you all for responding. That's the meeting that we are discussing the proposal that came from the special small committee on the recovery fund small committee. and so we'll be discussing that proposal and moving forward with it. So 4:30, September 15th. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, and while we're talking about that, can we please stop referring to this as anything relating to ARPA? This is not ARPA. This is our county recovery
fund. That's what I said.
I've seen a lot of emails going back and forth and people getting confused. ARPA's been decided. This is the recovery plan that's going to be funded with fund balance. Thank you.
Okay, looking forward to a robust discussion on
September 15th. Thank you all so much for responding. All right, let's move on to the rest of our agenda. And like I said, let's power through it. Standing in special committees. Oh, wait a minute. Resolutions to be added or withdrawn from the agenda.
Martha's got her hand up.
Sorry, got to yell out.
I want to help us move on. I'm going to pull Resolution S and Resolution V.
Pull Resolution N and Resolution
S as in Sam, V as in Victor.
Sam and Victor being pulled from the agenda. Thank you, Martha. Any resolutions?
S as in Sam.
Yes, Sam and Victor.
Got it. Okay. Thank you.
Anything being added to the agenda?
I think Shauna Black may have a resolution to be withdrawn. It was tabled at the budget committee today.
How are you holding out?
Resolution. Yeah, Madam Chair, it was I know. I'm just explaining it.
Okay, what resolution is being pulled?
I guess we're pulling resolution O, ID 10327, budget adjustment and appropriation of unspent funds for 2020 and priors to various accounts of the departments that report to the Health and Human Services Committee.
Okay.
So I guess my question is, if budget didn't pass it, could we still vote on it this evening? Or were there too many questions?
That's what I was going to try to explain.
Okay.
You have a response, Deborah?
I think it's yeah, good. Okay. So what happened was this had to do with a resolution for the health department to spend about $152,000 of its rollover, which totaled in excess of $500,000. $297,000 of that was attributable, according to the paperwork, to the New York State Department of Health declaring an imminent threat to public health that permitted an increase in state aid reimbursement on COVID-related expenses. And so the children with special care needs nurses who worked on the COVID response would normally have not been eligible for state aid, but the health department received funding from the state to the tune of about $297,000. Martha raised the question as to whether that was consistent with the county policy that, as a general rule, funds that had to do with wages and personnel expenses that were not spent didn't go into a department's rollover. So that was one question. And Rick pointed out that he and Jason had certified this rollover, but the committee still had questions. So I pointed out that $287,000 was not necessary in order for the health department to spend the $152,000 that it was asking for. But Mike Lane suggested that if it turned out that the health department didn't actually have that $297,000 in rollover, the department might decide they didn't want to spend the $152,000 in the manner that was specified in the resolution. So with those questions pending, the majority of the committee voted to table the resolution, and that's where we left it. So you decide what you want to do. I guess the question to Frank is this time sensitive?
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm back. Is it okay if I go?
Hi, Frank. Yeah, we were questioning if the resolution O ID 10327 is time sensitive.
Yeah, we are trying to move those things forward because they're for this year. And all of it is, well, not all of us, but much of it is IT equipment that's designed to make our spaces more usable in this new virtual environment. And it just makes it more difficult for us to implement some of that virtual work that we want to do without it.
All right, so I think this resolution can still move forward under HHS, even if budget didn't pass it. So what is it you want to do?
Let's go ahead and move forward and see if we can start conversation and get answers.
All right, we'll leave it on the agenda then. All right, so I'll go to standing committees. And Shauna, you're up. Health and Human Services Committee. Shauna Black, Chair.
Thank you very much. Let's see here. I would like to move Resolution O, Budget Adjustment and Appropriation of Unspent Funds for 2020 and Prior Years to Various Accounts of the Departments that report to the Health and Human Services Committee, ID 10327.
My trusted advisor says that you should move it as adopted by the Health and Human Services Committee.
Okay.
That language has to be in there.
I would like to move it as adopted by the Health and Human Services Committee. Thank you.
Okay. May I have a second? Second by Amanda Champion. Any further discussion?
Yes. There's an issue, if I may.
I'll let Deborah go.
Sure. When the resolution was presented to BCP, the numbers had been adjusted. So if you look in your... if you look in your red folders, you can find a copy of the resolution with red type across the top that indicates what the actual numbers are. And I would assume that regardless of the action that BCP did or did not take, that these are the numbers that we would be passing tonight.
So the revised version 155020 instead of?
Yes, ma'am.
Could be an amendment made. There could be an amendment made on the floor.
So I would move that amendment if we're going to consider it and ask if it's friendly.
With the numbers that were in, or are you moving to revise?
Yes, resolution. That's what I'm.
Okay. That's seconded by Rich. Any further discussion?
Friendly.
There's further discussion from Leslie. Deborah, I'm sorry, go ahead. And then Leslie.
Yeah, I guess the question that I would ask that would determine how I would vote is, Frank, if you found out that your rollover account was $297,000 smaller than you thought it was, would you still want to use $155,000 of it for the purposes stated in this resolution?
Yes.
Thank you.
Nice and succinct. I appreciate that. Leslie.
So I voted in support of this at HHS, and I would still support it. I just want to understand what the pretty substantial change in the numbers are.
Second.
Sure. I can answer that if you'd like me to. Sorry. Yeah, really the main change is that we're unable to procure the electric vehicles this calendar year. You will see this in our rollover request in our 2022 budget. Those vehicles will be put back in for that same amount.
Okay. That satisfy you, Leslie? Great. Mike Lane.
I'll pass for now.
Okay, Mike is passing. Any other, Martha?
So this just would approve the spending, and then BCP will go back and kind of make sure there's a correct calculation consistent with our policies on what rollover is left. Is that the way I understand it?
Yeah. There's noddings of yes.
Okay. Thank you. Can't see the nodding. Thank you.
Yeah, that's what I'm telling you. So there So the revised one was proposed, was that, and I'm sorry, I did ask for a second, but was that friendly yes. to the mover and second of the original? So through voting on this and then voting again. All right, let's vote. The revised version on the table with the adjusted numbers. Yes, Frank needs it. Yesterday. Vote.
Rich John?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Hertzen?
Yes.
Leslie Shue?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Anda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Leslyn McBean-Claiborne?
Yes.
13 ayes, 0 noes.
Thank you. That passes. Anything else from you, Shauna?
The rest of my report is that we will be meeting September 19th at 1 p.m. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Facilities and Infrastructure Committee, Mike Lane, Chair.
Yes, we met on August 19th. A lot of what we did were in the resolutions for the airport that we passed on the consent agenda. We have a highway resolution about our culvert projects. And we have a small contingency resolution. I'll move that about restoring our historic matte painting from the lobby here. I guess that's enough, unless, Dave, there's other things you'd like me to mention?
No, I think that covers it.
Okay.
All right. Any questions to Mike on his report? Go ahead, Victor. Resolutions, Mike.
Let's do... Resolution P, the appropriation for, I'm moving the revised version as adopted by the BCP committee, which I believe everybody has. Appropriation from the contingent fund to cover expenses related to the restoration of the Tompkins County, I'm sorry.
P was Jenna, Q is what was revised.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
That's fine.
I'm messed up. Let me move Q first. Approved funding agreement with New York State Department of Transportation for a culvert replacement project pending, and that was ID 10322, and that's the one I moved the revised version of, because we made a small change at BCP.
All right, seconded by Dave McKenna. Any discussion on the resolution? All right, let's vote on it. Thank you.
Rich John?
Yes.
Fine?
Yes.
Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Leslie Shue?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Bert Dawson?
Yes.
McBean-Claiborne?
Yes.
13 ayes, 0 noes.
Okay, that carries.
Now I'll come back to Resolution P. That's the to cover the expenses from contingency for the restoration of the historic map. Appropriation from contingent fund to cover expenses related to the restoration of the Tompkins County Historic Map. Facilities Department, it's ID 10325, and I so move.
I have a second. Seconded by Glenn Morey. Discussion? All right. Let's take it to a vote, please.
Rich John?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Leslie Shue?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Leslie McBean-Claiborne?
Yes.
13 ayes, 0 noes.
Thank you. That carries.
Thank you, folks.
Thank you, Mike. Tompkins and the Governmental Relations Committee, Martha Robertson, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tiger has not met since the last legislature meeting, but we were able to schedule a meeting this Friday with Senator Mike Giannaris. He's Deputy Majority Leader of the State Senate, so we'll be meeting with a couple of his staff and the senator this Friday at 11 o'clock by Zoom. This is about the state the redistricting process at the state level. And I've invited anybody who wants it. Leslie plus Tiger members are planning to join us. If anybody else is interested, I can make sure you get the Zoom as well. So that's my, I guess the only other thing is the next Tiger meeting has been moved. It was going to be next Tuesday, but because of the NYSAC conference, we've moved it to the following Tuesday, September 21st at 10 a.m. And that's my report.
Thank you. Any questions to Martha? Okay. Moving on. Government Operations Committee, Amanda Champion, Chair.
Thank you. Government Operations met on September 2nd, which was last week, I think. We had a really nice presentation from the Tompkins County Public Library folks. The three leadership team members who are acting as the director right now. So if you're interested in that, please go back and watch the very beginning of the GO meeting. They did a great job and gave us an update on everything the library has been doing. We had a couple of resolutions. And let's see, the other thing that you all should know is that we did have a conversation with Kathy and Dominic about going forward with our meetings, both this full meeting and committee meetings, and if we want to continue offering the hybrid option for some people to be on Zoom and some people to be in person. The overwhelming majority said that yes, we do want to continue using Zoom as our platform and offering this hybrid option. Now, we have even more of an incentive too, since not all voting members have to be present. So we gave our staff that direction and they're gonna keep working out all the details for us. And then the last thing I'll mention is that we had a first discussion about our proposed changes to rules 5 and 17 of our rules of the legislature. A small subcommittee of Rich and Leslie and I met a couple of times to talk about the idea of a code of conduct for legislators. And we ended up coming to the conclusion that we should really not make a whole new document, but bring these ideas into the current rules of the legislature that we have. So we revised two of the rules that were already in there, and we added some thoughts, did some more basic editing, and we had a discussion about that at GEO. I think the discussion went pretty well. There was a few further changes and a few questions, but ideally we will be bringing that back to the next GEO meeting as a resolution to vote on, and we'll come here to the full legislature. So if you're interested in talking more about that, you can let me know. You can watch the GO meeting. You can look at the packet. There was both a clean version and a red line version in there. And our next meeting, I never know the date. It's the first Thursday of the month.
All right. Thank you, Matt. Any questions for Matt on her report? Annie?
Thanks, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure, just put in my two cents about for the code of ethics that when you go through it again, since advisory boards were added.
Annie, we haven't done that. When we do that resolution, I'm going to talk about it. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. We haven't gotten to the resolution yet.
All right, thanks.
All right, anyone else questions on the report? Go ahead and move your resolution.
Okay, so resolution R, adoption of local law number E of 2021, a local law amending chapter 32 of the Tompkins County Code of Ethics. And I would move that.
May I have a second, please? Seconded by Leslie Schill. Discussion. Yes.
So Annie had brought up the question about under the definitions of the new definitions that were edited, we do add in the words advisory board as people who are bound by this code. And so Annie's suggestion was that we should also add that into the title. So I think the suggestion was something like, the very first line would say a local law establishing standards of conduct for officers, employees, and advisory board members to the County of Tompkins. Something, well, I think that wording makes sense. So I did ask Kathy. She said that that was not necessarily a substantive change, but I could, do we need to make an amendment to do that?
I think an amendment should be offered, but I would want Jonathan to comment too to make sure he is in agreement with that.
I agree it's not a substantive change. I mean, the plain truth, I think it was intended to cover advisory boards in the first place. It just didn't really say so. But I thought that you were really clarifying, but it was always intended to cover advisory boards, I believe. So I don't really think it is a change at all. If it helps clarify, that's fine.
Okay, well, just for clarity and transparency, maybe we should just move it as an amendment and get it in there. That would be fine. Rich, other discussion?
Yeah, I'd move to amend the title to a local law establishing standards of conduct for officers, comma, employees, and advisors to the County of Tompkins.
All right, second by Deborah. Show me ask a question. The mover and seconder first. Was that the? No, let's just go ahead and vote on it. This is. Michael?
Is advisors too broad? Should it be in members of advisory boards?
In the document itself, it refers to advisory boards, but I could certainly change my motion to it. Officers, comma, employees, and advisory board members.
I think that makes sense, right?
Of the County of Tompkins.
Yeah, that actually makes sense. And that's all friendly all around. Any other discussion, Annie?
Thank you. Sorry for commenting, Amanda, before you put it forward. For some reason, I thought you maybe you were going to put it back to committee. So then I'm just wondering if there's other parts in the local law that need to be changed or, you know, in the code of ethics, wherever it refers to employees and officers. Do we need to add advisors?
If I could respond to that, Madam Chair, if you look under Section 2 definitions, F, subsection F, a county officer or employee means a paid or unpaid officer or employee at Tompkins County, including but not limited to the members of any county board. So I think that that covers it.
I think that covers it as well.
Okay, great.
And my earlier point was that was always intended to cover advisory boards, but I have no problem with clarifying that. But it was meant to include advisory boards.
Thank you, Jonathan. Annie, is there more?
I don't have an amendment, but I just wanted to, you know, comment on what Bob Lynch from Enfield brought up earlier regarding adding something about not endorsing or bringing up anything about politics or other offices, endorsing anybody or asking people to vote for anybody running for other offices. So I don't know how other people felt.
Amanda?
So that's actually something that we worked into the rules revision that we just did. It's not really necessarily, I don't think, something that would go in this code of ethics, but we did include a sentence or two in the rules.
Okay, thank you.
And the rules we have not seen yet. These are the rules that you're working on.
This says GL, yeah.
Okay. Anyone else? Anything else? And now I don't remember where we are. We're on the floor with
voting on the amendment.
Yes. So, all right. Let's vote on the amendment to add advisory board and members of the advisory board members. Roll call vote.
Rich John?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Wayne?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Leslie Shill?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Leslie McBean-Claiborne?
Yes.
13 ayes, 0 noes.
Okay, so this is now the main motion. Any other discussion on the main motion? Thank you very much. Let's vote on the main motion.
Rich John?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Leslie Shill?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Leslie McBean-Claiborne?
Yes.
13 ayes, 0 noes.
Much. Annie, do you have your hand up again? I can't tell. No? Okay. Just a hang on her hand. Planning energy. Oh, Amanda, anything else?
Nope. Thank you.
Thank you. Planning energy and environmental quality committee and Corman chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We met on August 23rd and, the bulk of the meeting was centered around Ken Schlather, from the director from CCE, Cornell Cooperative Extension, came to kind of give a rundown on his budget. Some of the core questions we had are still outstanding. We really wanted to know how our money was spent that the county gives last year, and a little bit and a better breakdown. And we were hoping for their audit to be finished by now. I think it was like 2019 audit, I think, isn't completed yet. Amanda, I know, keeps better track of that than me, but their financial audit. So I've been meaning to send that out to people. I'll send you a link with the his presentation and a link to our meeting on the 23rd and what minute his presentation starts. So I'd really like folks to watch that so that hopefully questions can be sent to him ahead of time so he can be prepared to answer things that will hopefully make give us more information when he does present at the budget time, because I know we often have questions of him for the organization. We also rescheduled the December peak meeting to December 15th at 1:30 p.m. so that any resolutions or actions we pass at that point will be able to be followed up at a legislative meeting before the end of the year. And last, I just want to mention, I'm not going to the NYSEC conference, but I'm going to attend the planning and the economic, I can't remember the whole name of it, but the economic, energy, environmental meeting. And I put an email into one of the organizers to see if we could, if members who want to go to that or who are members of that committee attend remotely, and that might also apply for other committees. And they emailed me back and they said they were going to look into it. So apparently they hadn't thought about people being able to call in yet. So I will let folks know about that. And that's, and we're going to meet again on the 27th of this month, but there's a meeting before that, so I'll give you more details then. There's a legislative meeting before then.
Thank you. Questions for Annie? All right. Thank you, Annie. Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee, Deborah Dawson, Chair.
Oh, as usual, we haven't done much. We had a special meeting today, and we passed several resolutions that had gone through other committees. We also passed the fund balance policy resolution, but I noticed that it's not on this agenda because it did not pass GO. So I'm wondering, Kathy, will we consider this at our next legislature meeting?
I believe that's when it's targeted for.
Okay. Great. Thank you. So just a warning, you guys, because if any of you have missed the extensive discussions that we've already had about this in two committees, you will have an opportunity to weigh in on it at our next legislature meeting. That's pretty much all I have, except I'm sure you're all as excited as I am to move into the expanded budget committee phase of our year. And also, I want to thank Annie for looking into that NYSAP planning and economic development committee meeting, because I'm on that committee as well. But this year, they scheduled it at the same time as taxation and finance. And since I'm the only person from this county, yeah, who's on taxation and finance, I will be going to that one. So I hope you can tune into the economic development one. Thanks.
All right. Any questions for Deborah? Thank you very much. Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee.
I'm sorry. I meant to
go ahead.
Yeah, I meant to ask about the county administrator and county attorney searches. Is there any update? I wasn't sure if that was under your report, and then I thought when that went by, and then I thought, well, maybe that would go under budget.
I think we know that the position's been posted, and I can't remember exactly what the closing date is, but until the closing date, I'm sure we're not going to hear much of an update to give anymore.
Okay, and we still don't have the search committee yet finalized?
You'll get an email on the search committee.
Okay, thank you very much.
Everyone will get an email on the search committee. Anything else with Deborah? Workforce Resilience Inclusion Committee. Henry is not here. Anybody who's a member of that committee here who might be able to share if anything happens? That's okay.
I could say I attended, but I'm not ready to report for it.
That's all right. That's all right. Double up with the next meeting. Get more information. And I'll make sure I follow up with Henry so we can get information when he's not here. Housing and Economic Development Committee, Martha Robertson, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We met on, we met a week and a half ago. And we had a number of resolutions that were on our consent agenda. I have two on the main list here, although we have pulled Resolution S on the broadband initiative in the town of Newfield. I think people should have seen emails about this, but the idea is we have instead asked to have a legislature meeting on September 14th to be able to consider this resolution when we have more information from Spectrum as a potential provider of broadband in the town of Newfield. So that's briefly the reason I asked to pull Resolution S. It did pass our committee. Our next legislature meeting, our next Housing and Economic Development Committee meeting will be Thursday, September 23rd at 9:30. And then I have a bond resolution for, it's a very long title. I hope I don't have to read the title. Kathy Boss, do I have to read the whole title?
Yeah, you could summarize it.
All right. It's a resolution approving issuance of a tax-exempt revenue bonds for Kendall at Ithaca. They're refinancing a bond that we had approved a number of years ago. The ID number is 10337, and I so move.
May I have a second, please? Rich John seconds. Discussion on the resolution. Okay, let's vote on it.
Rich Jan?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Leslie Show?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Jonna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Clairvoyant? Yes. 13 ayes, 0 no.
Thank you. That carries. Aging out.
No, just that special meeting on September 14th is just before the expanded budget committee meeting. So I appreciate folks making the time to do that. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Martha. Downtown Facilities Committee, Dave McKenna, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Downtown Facilities has not met since the last ledge meeting. We will be meeting this Thursday at 3 o'clock in these chambers or on Zoom. Yes. And it's my report.
Thank you. Any questions to Dave on his report? Thank you, Dave. Public Safety Committee, Rich John, Chair.
The Public Safety Committee has not met since our last meeting, but we'll be meeting September 16th at 3 o'clock. And I would just report our jail numbers are tracking where they had been, roughly. We currently have 37 people in our jail with 4 board outs.
Any questions for Rich? Thank you. Thank you, Rich. Moving on to individual member filed resolutions. Resolution U, submitted by Legislative Horman, Dawson, and Robertson. Who's on?
Trying to find this in my 100 and something pages. Thank you for your patience. Okay.
That's all right.
All right. This is a resolution opposing the proposed public auction of certain property on the east shore of Cayuga Lake by the New York State Electric and Gas Corporation. I'm just going to tell you a little bit, and then I'm going to hand it over to Deborah, who has taken
Have a second on it first, please.
Okay.
Seconded by Deborah. Go ahead.
So Deborah Dawson has done the lion's share of the research and advocating and also writing up this resolution. Before I hand it over to her to talk a little bit more about it, I'm encouraging everybody to sign the petition. I sent out a link today, and hopefully people can sign that and share it. There are the petition is opposing the public auction of this property by NYSEG. We have 3,200 signatures thus far. We're hoping to get to 5,000. And Anna Kellis, our state assembly person, did ask us to try and promote this. It does make a difference to get more signatures on the petition. We're hoping to get to 5,000. So I'll give it to Deborah Dawson to take it away from here. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Annie. I think that the resolution is pretty much self-explanatory. There was a meeting in the town of Lansing a couple of weeks ago. It was Pam Helming's mobile office hours, and it was extremely well attended. I think the senator was pleasantly surprised that most of the people were there because they were upset about this proposed auction that just kind of appeared out of nowhere without any previous notice. The town government, the planning board, the citizens of the town, everybody's on board with trying to save this property, which is unique in so many ways and so valuable as one of the few places that not only has public access to the lakefront, but also has level ground along the shore, which is really unusual for us. So for all of those reasons, everybody does not want to see it turned over to a private developer to be turned into another housing development. And I drafted the whereases, but I didn't quite know what to do about the resolved clause because
I know people who are at a much higher pay grade than myself are working on this. So I asked Andy Zepp, who's been working closely with Senate, with Assemblywoman Kellis and somewhat with Senator Helming, what our results should look like so that it would support the efforts that they're all making in Albany. And so the results clause is a product of that inquiry.
Thank you, Deborah. Any other discussion?
That certainly will support this. This piece of property has been under our radar for a lot of years. Planning Department did a study of the all the lands around Cuba Lake a few years ago, and this was pointed out as being one of the most important to keep in the public sphere. We don't want to lose this to, as you say, private development debt. I would like to see the county own it, frankly. I don't know what's going to happen here, but it definitely should not go to auction.
Yeah, I just want to say that, you know, the town of Lansing has pretty much worked on this for the last decade, I think, with Andy Zepp. I mean, I remember when this came up, probably was a decade ago. There was some feeling that maybe people in the town were not for this. I just wanted to say that was never the case. They just would prefer it to be a state forest as opposed to a state park. But I think they would kind of settle for anything right now. To my friends who would say, you know, that this should go to public auction and be because they would like to see the tax benefits of it being developed, I would say, you know, we can't develop everything in the county for maximum profit. I mean, if we were to do that, we would, you know, we would develop housing in Buttermilk Falls. I mean, there has to be some level of, wow, this property is something that we would like to open to the public. Here's how we get that done. I'm afraid that really the only way to get this done would be if Governor Hochul decided to step in and have the state buy the land. I mean, I talked to Fred Bond about this over at the parks. He says it's gotten all the way up to Segos. So there are people talking about this. And I'm afraid that's the only way that this would happen. I don't even know if NYSIG, frankly, is allowed to kind of just form a deal. I have no idea. They have, you know, they're regulated by the state, so they might have fiduciary responsibilities. And that's the only reason I think that maybe if the governor were just, if she said, I want to make an environmental statement early on in my my governorship, this would be the one to do it. So hopefully, not that she's watching, but if people know her, this would be a great time for her to step in. So thanks.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Rich.
I'm just wondering,
Jonathan, I see you. Sorry. Go ahead, Rich.
Do you have any sense of valuation without saying what that might be and whether there are state resources that could be applied to that?
Jay Franklin said the assessed value was somewhere around 1.7 or 1.9 million.
And did Pamela Helming indicate there was state money that could be applied here? Or?
She didn't say anything specifically. Okay. Interestingly enough, I mean, the DEC has designated the Finger Lakes Land Trust as an acquirer, and I would assume that that means that they're planning to kick in some money. We can certainly put in $200,000 from our natural infrastructure fund, but that's not really very much.
I was inferring that from what was written here, but I was wondering if there was anything more explicit stated yet.
No.
Okay. Thanks.
Jonathan.
A couple things. One, to answer Mike Sigler's question, my understanding is that NYSEG needs permission from the Public Service Commission. My understanding is that the Public Service Commission is not going to say no. Let's put it that way, unless the governor says say no. To the extent they say anything, you know. I do know a little more about money, but that's a sort of executive session, I think, conversation, because it is going to be auctioned unless it's stopped. And if people want to talk about money, that would be an executive session. I mean, we have an assessment on it at 1.9. That's not the figure at which it's going to sell.
Yes, Deborah.
Yeah, it's interesting, Jonathan. I know that the posting for the auction says that it was subject to PSC approval. And I guess everybody had kind of assumed that was the case. But then somebody raised the question of whether or not they really needed PSC approval, because this particular piece of property was not designated as an energy installation or facility. So that's kind of up in the air. But if the PSC has to approve it, I guess the criteria they use really revolve around, you know, the benefits to the ratepayers of NYSEG receiving a particular amount of money.
Yeah, it would be to auction it off to get the maximum amount of money. I mean, that's
right.
So, you know, I mean, they're getting approval is, you know, unless someone says don't do it, like the governor, that's not an avenue.
Well, I'm curious to know. I mean, I guess the county could always bid on it if that was our inclination, but I think that would require a meeting and being prepared to spend boatloads of bucks, and you know, that's not something we could.
Right. I want to ask you, but I also saw Lisa jump on. Lisa, did you want to add something before I get Mark in?
Just a quick comment from Megan from planning, who weighed in prior to leaving the meeting today, that just to say if the legislature were to act on the property, it would require SEAKER. Maybe you were already aware of that, but just wanted to point that out. And you could choose to override the Natural Infrastructure Program project maximum if you chose to.
All right. Thank you for that. Martha.
That's a good piece of information. Thank you, Lisa.
Yep.
I think that there should be a case, since DEC is interested in this. The Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, which, you know, the whole of state government is working on recommendations to fight climate change. And there's a whole agriculture and forestry panel talking about we have to optimize and really increase our forest resources. I think we have an argument to make that development, I mean, as Mike Ziegler said, we shouldn't be, you know, not every single, we have a housing crisis, of course, but not every single piece of property should be developed for housing. So we also have a connection to John Howard, who's the interim chair of the Public Service Commission. He used to live in the crown jewel of Tompkins County for a while, in Dryden. And we, you know, some of us have a relationship with him. If there's any way, if this is, you know, the will of the board of the legislature, we can certainly reach out and try to actually get a meeting with him, if that's something that, we should do. I mean, I think that's not impossible. Well, it might be hard, but not impossible.
All right. I don't want to get too far from what the resolution is about and get into, you know, too much conversation about whether we're going to build houses or ask you park or whatever.
So I just wanted to know, will we know in advance when the auction date is? Will there be like a 30-day notice or something like that?
It's up right now.
Is it?
30 days.
It's in the posting. I mean, if you go look at it, I think the link is in the
starts October 11th. It is in 33 days, 14 hours, and 48 minutes.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you.
I just think we need a roadmap how to go forward with this. I think planning and administration ought to give us some options, knowing that this is out there and that it may go forward to this auction. And if that happens, what are our options as a county to protect this land?
Okay. Any administrator heard us? Let's see, can hand Andy to the
Dave McKenna?
Okay. It's the cursor. any other discussion? Dave?
Thank you. I guess I'd like to make a motion and authorize administration to reach out to PSC and let's see if we can do any good in that vein, since time is short.
So there's a motion on the table opposing this option, but now you are asking to have administration reach out. You're offering a different action.
Or an additional action?
Additional action. I'm not opposing.
You should want him to do his.
Say that again.
I think you ought to do what's on the table and then go to Dave.
But let's get through the motion that's on the table. And then we'll take up what you're offering. So, we take the still vote. Thank you. Let's vote, please.
Rich Chern?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Blaine?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Leslie Schoaf?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
Eyes 13, 0 no's.
That carries. Thank you very much.
Okay, I'll repeat the motion, and that is to allow administration to reach out to the PSC through whatever means possible to see if we can preempt this auction.
Okay, everybody's clear on the motion?
Yes.
Okay, all right, second by my claim. Discussion. Yes, Amanda.
I guess I'm not sure what you mean by preempt. Like,
prevent it.
Okay, like what we can do? I guess I was
listening. No, we have a link to, we have people that know people at PSC. Okay? Reach out to those people and see what we can do to prevent the auction or at least slow it down.
First, I have a question. I don't see PSC Chair John Howard in the resolved. I thought I saw an email about that. Was that intended to be in the last resolved to send it to the PSC directly?
It's being sent to the Secretary of the PSC. I would assume that the stuff he sent to the Secretary of the PSC is distributed to the PSC. And nobody suggested where we might find John Howard. So, I mean, if somebody knows him, I was going to say.
Yeah, I actually sent his email around. I do know him.
I don't recall getting his email, but okay.
Okay, I thought I saw a response. Dave, Anna Kellis is also working actively on this. I think we can, whether it's administration or, Tiger, it's sort of more a political thing than administration would want to get involved in. I'd be happy to investigate what we can do and talk to Anna, for example.
I don't have a problem with it being through Tiger or administration, either one, whichever.
There's a motion on the table. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay. table, and we don't have to spend all night going through this. So I hear you. Alicia, you popped up. What are you? Have a comment? Okay, Deborah.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think administration's pretty busy right at the moment. And we might actually, I mean, I agree with you that we ought to be doing more than just sending up a resolution. But I'm not sure working through county government staff is the best way to do it. I mean, Martha has connections. We all know people in Albany. There's also people on the case board that know this John Howard guy. I think that we just need to get the word out to everyone that we know that has interactions with the PSC and with people in Albany that we're looking for any way around this.
Okay, so I'm hearing from the mover of the resolution that he doesn't care how he takes this up and not the administration.
I have no objections,
friend. Pardon?
It's friendly. I have no objection.
It is friendly. Tyler, take it up. Is it friendly to the seconder?
Sure. I just think we got to hit this from more than one direction.
Well, that's what they're saying. So yeah. Tyler, take it up, and we'll hit it from all kinds of directions.
It's really hard to hear all of you guys. Are you saying yes, Tiger should pick it up? And
Yes. Tiger, pick it up. Let's go. Right. Case, pick it up. Admin, pick it up. Whoever else got connections, pick it up.
Right. I don't think we need
a resolution for Tiger to pick it up. Right. Tiger can put it on their agenda. Minutes.
Let's see if you got teeth.
No.
Previous meeting moved by seconded by Leslie Show. I'm looking around. Any discussion on the minutes?
Both sets.
Okay, let's vote.
Both sets.
Oh, we have two sets of minutes, actually. Yeah. Sorry, because we did have a special committee. Shawnee, you're moving both. Let's see you second and vote. All right. Let's vote on the minutes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Dave Horman?
Yes.
Blaine?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Leslie Schill?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Leslie Bean Clairborn?
Yes.
No, Sarah. Tired.
Look at that, Kathy said at the end of the night. All right. Any unfinished business? Moved by everyone. May I have a second? Moved by Amanda. Second by everyone. People, please take care of yourselves. Lots of people getting, you know, just fatigued, everything else. We'll see you at the next meeting.